Coming to you from the City of the Weird. Exploring topics from the esoteric and unexplored to dimensions unknown. Shining a light of truth on the darkest corners of our reality. Welcome to the Curious Realm.
Well, hello everybody. Happy Tuesday night. Coming at you from Austin. Had a nice little cup of cappuccino. Delicious. Been a fiend for cappuccino here in the last month or so. I got a cappuccino machine for the family after my last stint on the road. And boy, has it changed research here at the house. That's all I can say. Changes the way you do everything. But we have an exciting show tonight. We have quite a few exciting shows coming up, actually. Let me pull out the, let me do the old rush. Check the guest list here, everybody. Next week, actually, we are excited to bring back Stephen Bassett from Paradigm Research. We will be talking with him about the ongoing cause of disclosure in Washington. We will also be bringing aboard Bob Spearing next week, Director of International Development for MUFON. We will be talking about some cases of interest that he will be presenting on at the upcoming MUFON Symposium next month in Covington, Kentucky. And then the week after, on the 28th, we will be welcoming back Gretchen Cornwall. She's talking about her new book about Royston Cave, which my copy arrives Wednesday. And I will be voraciously tearing through that to get questions ready, things like that. She found Royston on the map of Zena Halpern and in Zena Halpern's work, and then really brought the carvings and the story of that to Oak Island and to the producers of that, and became a research associate on that end. And they did a whole episode on that. And her work in Royston is extensive and amazing. And I'm very, very glad to see her getting this groundbreaking book about the Knights Templar and Royston Cave out. And then we will also be welcoming Sylvia Sterling, who is a Lyrid starseed as well as a cat whisperer, and just did the episode record with her the other day for pre-recording. It was a great conversation, so stay tuned for that. Then, of course, at the beginning of August, we will be premiering all of our coverage from Cygames. We will be going to the annual Cygames this year. It is in Charlotte, North Carolina. Get your tickets now, folks. There's only a few tickets left. Cygamesinternational.com is where you can go to get tickets. This is one of the most amazing events I have ever attended, and I cannot wait to go again this year and talk to all of the amazing participants, talk to all of the panelists, researchers, everything. It is just an amazing, amazing event. And tonight, in the second part, we welcome back our good friend, Dr. John Hall. We are talking about MKUltra and the new hearing, their panel that just happened, with the House panel on declassifying government secrets and what that is all about. So it's a great episode. We go deep into some of the things that they talk about, go deep into MKUltra, what the plan was, what the plan still is, as we talk about regularly with Dr. John Hall. That never stopped. It just changed. It just moved location and went under a different banner. And in our first segment tonight, we welcome back our good friend, founder of 5x5 News, investigator Mike Turber. We are starting the episode on the topic of Tranche 4. Tranche 4 from the Department of War was just released. It was released on July 8th, the famous date of the Roswell announcement, things like that. And what do you make of the trenches, Mike? Welcome back to the show, my friend.
Well, thank you for having me and appreciate it. Always good to be on your show. Absolutely love it. That's why we're doing the reveal.
That's all right, brother.
We're doing it again. You know, what I think so far of Tranche 4, it's almost like it's almost like a Jeremy Corbell situation where you have the hype and the buildup and stuff and you get right to it and you're kind of like, okay, please something come out that just is definitive. But there are some very interesting, there's some interesting videos in there. There's also some interesting documents as you go through that kind of lead to more questions. I think half the things that we're seeing gives us reason to say, okay, well, now we need something more, something a little bit more substantial, something that we can sink our teeth into. But some of the videos that are coming out, you know, some are interesting, some are, you know, I get amazed that they actually get to the point where someone says they can't identify them. But I do, I also understand from the government side too, whenever you get something, if you can't identify it, but you think it may be something, you can't say, well, we believe it may be this, but we still have to categorize it as unidentified. So it just simply goes unidentified. If they can't identify exactly what it is, then it's unidentified. And then that's the reason why a lot of people wonder, well, they can't tell that's a bird. They can't tell that's a balloon. They can't tell that's a this or that. And that's the reason for it, folks. It's not that, you know, we have a whole bunch of, you know, not so bright people that are looking at these things. It's that if they can't concrete or basically specifically tell you what it is, then they have to keep it listed as unidentified. And so it just goes into a much broader category, and that's why we see it like that.
And like we've said before, part of the problem scientifically, I was never a fan community-wise or research-wise of, or at least not like FOIA research-wise, of the relabeling of UFO to UAP. That was dirty pool.
Because
that suddenly like FOIA requests stopped because, you're looking for something about UFOs and we don't look into UFOs. We look into UAPs. Mm-hmm. Now, as far as science went, beautiful, because a UFO is, like we've said numerous times on the show, I always use the Kleenex analogy.
Mm-hmm.
Kleenex. Hey, you need to blow your nose? Here's a Kleenex. Here's the thing, though. Science doesn't like Kleenex. Science likes to describe. They like to categorize. They like to stratify things. That is literally what science does, is categorize. What they want to hear is, I have some facial tissue.
Mm-hmm.
And of that facial tissue, we have single ply, double ply, triple ply, pleated, non-pleated, patterned, unpatterned, scented, unscented, lotioned, unlotioned. You know, now we're getting into phenomena of the Kleenex.
Mm-hmm.
You know, now we're getting into nitty gritty. Science is all about that. So it was great because it brought in science, but it was horrible because it really stymied a lot of the research within community for a long time.
Yeah, but even so, I mean, remember the big fiasco they had with the NASA, member 25-member panel that they brought on board, and there was a lot of harassment going on.
Absolutely.
You know, and that's, you know, I guess that's going to happen almost anywhere, but once something takes on the social media side of it, and you try to appeal to that crowd, you've got to do that a much more guided process. I mean, someone can't come out there that's a greenhorn and jump into this big pool with all these sharks in it and expect to be, you know, stay alive. No, you're going to be eaten up because they're just going to do it. So, you know, that being said, you've got a lot of different, you know, people out there that are capable of doing this research, but you're right. They're turned off to it to some degree because of the stigmatism behind it, or because of the fact that as they've seen colleagues of theirs go into it, those people are having a tough time trying to get a point across. It's also the same for, you know, for skeptics too. I mean, when we come out with something, we say, oh, that object was a blah, blah, blah. I get it all the time. So, but, you know, it does happen. When you see it happen, you kind of like, well, you would think that people would want to know what something is. And then when you do tell them what it is, then, you know,
it's like you destroyed their paradigm.
Exactly. And so you got to do it in a, or try to do it in a way that doesn't really, you know, destroy the floor that you're trying to build, you know, that same foundation. You've got to have people on both sides. You've got to look at it and try to present the information in as factual way as possible. The key thing I do when I'm doing my investigation and then my subsequent reporting of it is I try not to utilize eyewitnesses so much, but a lot of people admonish me for that. But at the same time, it kind of protects me because I'm not trying to tell someone that they didn't see something.
That's right.
I can't do that. I can't take away a memory from someone. So whatever anyone says they saw. You know, I there's no way to, you know, you're not going to change that. All I want to do is, that's why I always look at the empirical data, the physical data, anything that I can get that's tangible and actually look at it and go, okay, well, this is either A, most likely, or it absolutely is this or that. And then I present that. And that's why I do the court cases, and that's kind of the same approach I've had here.
Well, and you know, the issue that comes to bear, again, I've said it again and again and again, and I'll keep saying it. This is not for us. This is for most people who are not onboarded to this conversation.
Right.
This is how you onboard them is, hey, no, look, seriously, the government took this serious for a long time. Mm-hmm. And here's a bunch of documents. The issue that you have is when it comes to researchers and even getting access to some of those documents, quite a bit is still redacted.
Yep.
Most of what is on the videos is redacted.
Right.
And that's what's more troubling than anything, is because the what's on the videos is not somebody's experience. It's not that they've given us people's experiences. They've given us the experiences of people who saw nuclear weapons go down and stuff like that. Mm-hmm. Like they've given us that. They've given us that, Mike. What they haven't given us is the cold, hard data for videos and photographs. All that stuff is still blacked out. And it's like that.
Or they conveniently lost it.
Yeah. And much like the GoFast video and that first panel where NASA was like, I don't know how this made it to us. We have all the data to do the trigonometry right here on screen. And it was like watching Zorro tear up something. Like they just eviscerated that with the trigonometry and the math.
Right. And that's what we, you know, GoFast was debunked within hours of that video coming out. I mean, I sent a email.
But it still made it to NASA. And that's the thing.
Yeah, it made it to them in that same form. And I was surprised that the people at NASA had not went out and looked to see, hey, I wonder if anyone else has done this. But it's good that they didn't. You know, if they do it after they do their investigation, then that's fine. Just like an internal peer review of saying, what? Now that we've done it, let's go see what everybody else is saying. But it's the same thing. The math for it is right in there. I did a video. Mm-hmm. Dr. Eric Davis said that my math was wrong, so I made a video about that, and he got mad about that.
I remember.
It was quite funny. It's still up. We can link it in the bottom here. So these things happen. So whenever you have the other thing about the videos when they come out is they're cut in the middle, so we don't get the full video. So someone had to take the complete video, and from that they had to cut out the part that they were willing to give to us, like a minute and 16 seconds, I think Tic Tac is, or something like that. So you have these little snippets in the middle. And then the other end of the spectrum is the question of, well, why is the resolution so low? Well, resolution can be low for several reasons, obviously, because Super 8, the old Super 8 or video, because it came on the same cassettes. That's what they actually used on the F-18s. And then you look at some of the older footage and, the Zapruder film is a classic example, too. You know, whenever people take that film, they don't really pull the whole thing. They don't show all the stuff leading up to it, which might give other clues. They just show that one little spot that we all remember.
Yeah.
And that too is a problem. So whenever I go in and I try to get this, I say, look, I'll send another request in and say, okay, obviously there's more to this video. Is that can that video be released, and then try to get that information out. That's kind of what I did with a couple of them that you'll see in the next week or so. The bigger problem is it's almost a systemic problem. It goes from one thing to another, from across the branches and what have you. But every now and then you'll get a breath of fresh air. You're just like, wow, okay, this is unique. And that's what happened to me with the NASA FOIA when I got that. I got a call within 2 days, and then I was told to call the weather center at Edwards Air Force Base and talk to the actual guy that was out there back when they were doing the test of the X-43 and all this other stuff. That's something unheard of. I've never experienced that before. So I was pretty happy about that.
Go ahead.
I was just going to say, I said, with what we're getting in these tranches is that we're getting that raw information that they have, that, you know, you have to wonder, are they going over something else to get to this and say, okay, let's give them that. That might be enough for now. But they're supposed to give everything. So if they don't, then obviously their heads will roll down the way. But, you know, there's a lot of information that's coming out from different segments, from different time frames, different years. I mean, it's all over the map. There's no real rhyme or reason to it. It's not like they're giving it to us chronologically, so we have a logical beginning. Like, say, we began at Roswell, and then say we're up through the 50s. Folks, we're getting closer. We're getting closer and closer and closer, or we're getting more and more, to give us, you know, some sort of range so we know how much more is coming. Because we don't have that number at all. This is the same memory. I think you remember in Vegas when I was doing the Vegas thing, when they started releasing the stuff weekly every Wednesday, we're down there at 10 o'clock in the morning trying to get all the evidence from the previous week.
Yeah.
And we still didn't know how many more weeks of information was going to come in. And that's the same thing we're in right now.
Well, and, you know, much like the programs that we talk about regularly, much like the technology for contractors that we talk about regularly, Mike, these things go on for years. When you and I met, it's 2015, you know,
wow, and it's been a while.
It doesn't seem like it's been like 12 years almost, but when you look at it, 2017, December 2017 is when we first saw video from the Nimitz.
Yep.
That is when we first, now that video was taken in 2004,
right?
That experience happened. Is so you're talking video and things that had already been kicking around in the back halls and things like that for 10 years.
Yeah.
For 10 years. Exactly. So right now we're looking, whenever you reference the Nimitz, the things like that, folks, this is no recent event. This is 20 years old. Just the announcement of it. We'll be coming up on that in a year, 19 years ago.
Yeah, December 16th.
We first saw Lou Elizondo. You and I sat down like a week or so, like the next week. I remember watching it and texting you and going, my God, man, I think you need to come on the show.
Yes.
So the fact that even now, like, you have been on this trail since that time, we've talked about it. We've talked about the fact that there were numerous platforms out there, that there was a huge exercise going on, that the Nimitz itself had been refitted with all kinds of new instrumentation, that there are laser pods on the F-18 that help create false images that look almost exactly like what we're looking at in that video. The fact that the only visual evidence that we have is from FLIR images. And like you said, what are the issues with artifacting? Things like that. The big thing that we are having you on about tonight, because in addition to these tranches, folks, once again, information comes out regularly. Mike sent me this document about a week ago. I'm going to pop it up on screen. A multi-agency forensic analysis of the 2004 Nimitz sensor anomalies. Coincident testing submerged ISR deployments in atmospheric clutter. Now, This document is, of course, available right there on our Knowledge Vault, folks. Feel free to stop on by curiousrealm.com/knowledge. Go to the UFO or paranormal section, or go to the science and scientific studies and docs. It's in both. But right there, it's that top link. Click it, and it'll take you right to the PDF where you can download it. You can read it. You can look at these things. You can see the notations of what we are going to be talking about. I have gone through this. I went through it whenever you first sent it to me. And then I was like, hey, man, send me that again, because I need to put it on my tablet where I can like do some real reading. And it's been interesting to plow my way through this. So let's start getting into this, Mike.
Yeah, there's a lot to unpack here. And
there
it does
is.
Get, without visualizations, it does make it a little bit more difficult. And just so everybody knows, the paper as it is right now, it's a pre-release to the scientific paper that I'll be releasing for peer review, for, you know, study, or for whatever. And then between this time, like right now, and this version of it, and the time that it finalizes, I'll be adding the graphics in it, finalizing some of the other stuff. I'm still trying to get the flight logs from a certain pilot, and as soon as I get that, I'm going to include that as well. So every time these things come out, it's an ongoing process. The scientific paper is not the final. You know, it's just like, okay, now it's going out for peer review. If something needs to be adjusted or corrected, or someone else comes up with different information down the road, then this becomes, you know, outdated, and then the new document or revision comes and takes over. And that's kind of what my work's been all along. It's just this constant revision. I think finally I'm down to the point now where I can actually turn all of the results that I have from this, especially from Nimitz, into a actual paper to submit for scientific review, for whatever. And put that out there. And plus, we're going into production on that documentary.
So. Well, and here's the important thing, Mike. Because like you said before the show, like we say all the time, just because data proves something else doesn't remove, and you're not trying to remove anybody's experience. You're not trying to remove a pilot's experience, what they felt in the cockpit, the moment of awe, what sent them down the rabbit hole. Right. And those guys above all else, like those, Fravor is a Top Gun pilot, man. Mm-hmm. He is among like the 20 best in the world at what he does, you know? So he is a well-oiled machine when it comes to what flies and how to maneuver around it with his machine and how to use his instrumentation. However, there's still a lot there going on with his observation.
Keep in mind, they weren't exactly expecting to see these objects.
Absolutely not. Here's the thing, though. As opposed to him, who's seeing things off bow of his aircraft, things like that, you've got Kevin Day, whose job was much more cold in its way, because he's just looking at data all day. He's looking at radar roughly. He's an instrumentist. He's looking at radar. He's looking at radio. He's looking at all kinds of platforms like that. So what he's looking at is actual data in front of him. So whenever, and the reason I bring that up is because like you've given this to Kevin Day, and he's like, right on, man. Good job.
Yeah. He said, rock star.
Because the thing is, aside from what was seen, there is the data. Yeah. There is the sensor platform data. There is the trail of what you get into, which is the numerous drone tests going on, the hypersonic test going on, the laying of the path for that.
Yeah.
You break down a lot of things that we have talked about on air numerous times over the last many years, and it's really cool to see this come to fruition, man. So let's
finally,
get into
this. It's been a long time.
Yeah.
It's been a long time. So one of the things, you know, for that morning on, November 14th, 2004, Kevin had been seeing objects on his radar screen since the 10th, and he saw them each day. They were coming in. They didn't have any airplanes in the air, so he wasn't so worried about him. He wasn't concerned. They didn't seem to be a threat. But he was seeing these objects, and they were coming in groups of, say, 5 to 10 or so, somewhere in that range, but normally 5 or 10. And then they began tracking south. And the ones particular to the date in question is they were tracking south. They just came across San Clemente at about, between 100 and 120 or so knots. And so when you look at this, the whole Nimitz picture, if you separate each individual sighting into a scene, like you have what Kevin Day saw, and we'll keep that on its own scene. That's like you're making a movie. And so the scene A is going to be Kevin Day, chronologically speaking. And then scene B will shift over to what Fravor saw, and we'll go from there. And then several hours later,
yeah,
we'll shift over to the Underwood situation. So you have three basic scenes. And so I treat them just like a forensic scene. So when I'm looking at them, I don't let one scene talk to the other scene unless I can actually draw the parallel between the two.
Sure.
With something either tangible or something, you know, that gives me a reason to do it.
An actual data point.
A data point. Something that I have a question I need, sure, the answer to, and the answer leads me over to scene B, and then, okay, well, that's what ties them together. So if you separate these things out like they were completely different sightings on their own, things get to be a little bit easier to make sense and understand. So here's what was happening in that whole area at the time. And this is a lot to unpack. Don't expect to grasp onto this all just at this one moment without having a visual. It's hard to do it. But, the month prior, you had the Operation Silent Hammer that was operating in the area where a whole bunch of, secret testing was being done, and just keep that in the back of your mind. So that's happened in October. Maybe some ships lingered around, maybe, or some other testing needed to be done, but that's all speculation. Well, okay, not really speculation, but we're just going to leave that alone. So now we move forward. So Kevin's seeing these objects. Now you have another situation, if you wanted to call it another scene, which was happening where the X-43, which is a hypersonic, basically like a hypersonic missile test that was being done to test the scramjet engine on the X-43, was going to be conducted on the 15th. So leading up to the 15th, you have all of these parameters that need to be looked at. You have to look at the upper aero winds. You have to look at sea conditions and all these different things. And the primary thing that was of a point of concern for the people that were flying the B-52, for the chase planes that were being flown, and also for, obviously, for the X-43, which is launched on the nose of a Pegasus rocket hanging below a B-52, when that rocket takes off, it's going to take off and it's going to push the X-43 to a certain speed. Then the X-43 is released. Its doors open up. Fuel or air comes in, mixed with the fuel, boom, scramjet goes, and it gets up to Coma said warp 9.6. It gets up
Mach 6.83.
I was just about to say warp 9.6. It gets up to Mach 9.6,
yeah,
which is 9.6 times speed of sound. And so, and it was a successful test. The problem is that November 15th, they had issues, so they had to push it to November 16th. So that was pushed a day later. So going back to November 14th, while the test for the X-43 was going to happen in the very much the same area, the weather patterns, the upper level air weather, had to be looked at. And NASA did it two different ways. They would launch weather balloons outside of the normal parameters of what all the other weather centers launch their balloons. So these balloons are launched normally each day at 12 Zulu and 0 Zulu. So you have two launches per day, basically 2,800 balloons go into the sky every day, everywhere, you know, all around the world. The United States has, I think, 900 to 1,000 or so balloons that go up here because we have the most. And so these things are happening. Then you have NASA, which is going to test the air patterns or the upper level winds, looking for wind shear, they're looking for, you know, whatever might be a problem. So they're doing that at altitude. So the balloon is launched, and the balloons generally go from the ground and they go up to about 110,000 feet before they burst. And they do so at about 1,000 feet per minute. So it takes about an hour and a half to 2 hours for a balloon to get to its bursting altitude. So when they launched, they launched these from different Air Force installations and also Navy installations around the area. So you had San Nicolas Island, which launched two balloons per launch. You had Point Magoo, which launched two balloons per launch. And you also had Vandenberg Air Force Base, which launched one balloon. Edwards Air Force Base, which is way, you know, on the other side of Los Angeles, also launched a balloon. And that was just for their climb out and their take, you know, when they come back. So you have these extra balloons that are in the air. Now, yeah, you have to take all of this into consideration here, too. When you look at the fact that the Spy-1B radar that was on the Princeton, that radar had just been upgraded just before they went out to do their workups to go out for their, I think they're going to the Arabian Sea was going to be their cruise. And so in that upgrade, one of the things that was not told to Kevin Day was the exact fidelity and all of these different things, some of the nuances and the changes that were going to happen as this, as the Spy-1B radar was upgraded. No one came in and said, hey, we're going to give you a briefing. You're going to be able to see this and this and this. You need to do all this other stuff. So that wasn't necessarily that didn't happen.
Sure.
And it was partly had to do with his clearance. He didn't have the exact clearance to do that. And this is all from me talking to Kevin Day. This isn't me just, you know, grabbing things out of there. This is a lot of conversations. And so things were showing up on the radar starting from November 10th. And then they ended drastically on November 16th. But in between, they were going to have this training. So that was on November 14th, which was a Sunday. And so as they got closer to the training, Kevin was starting to get a little bit worried that these objects, which seemed to be mundane and not much of a threat, were becoming a possible air hazard. So the morning of the 14th, he decided to send a couple. Well, first he had Kurse, you know, one of the red team members. He sent him over there, and by the time he was almost there, that's when he had Fravor and Dietrich, and he gave them bra commands to get them over to the location, bra's bearing range and altitude, and basically point them over there. So when he sent Fravor and Dietrich over, that was a whole nother scenario. So he's sending them over because he sees this problem happening. And since he had these objects that were in the sky and they were going to interfere with his training, he is responsible for that. It's his responsibility is to keep those pilots safe. And he says to get, you know, make sure that certain that they come home. But as he saw these objects coming into the area again for, fourth day in a row, he said, okay, we got to send somebody over there before we get a whole bunch more that's going to happen that afternoon. So when he sent Fravor and Dietrich over, when they got to the location where the object was supposed to be, there was nothing there. They didn't see anything. And so they looked around. Fravor saw some disturbance in the water, and that's when Fravor decided to go down towards it. All right, we're going to start that scene off in just another second. The objects that Kevin Day was seeing, and the reason why I brought up the balloons and things like that, the increase in the fidelity on the Spy-1B radar was so much that at this point, at that time, no one knew exactly what it was going to see. So you had to do a lot of adjustments to it. And basically it was supposed to null out items that were considered clutter, balloons, birds, you know, things like that.
Yeah,
that would, you know. But the problem is that you don't really want to rule out too much stuff because a stealth aircraft might look like a bird or something because it's that small of a signature. Anyway, so longer story longer. When he saw these objects coming down in those groups, I had a conversation with him on I think I was on Messenger with him. And I said, Kevin, let me ask you a question that's really been a stumbling block for me. Whenever you said they were in a formation tracking south at 100 to 120 knots, obviously, you know, at 28,000 feet, there's really not any planes that fly at 28,000 feet can fly that slow because that's well below the stall speed of almost any aircraft, in helicopter included. So naturally, in the back of my mind, I'm thinking it's got to be balloons because it kind of makes sense. And so I asked him, I said, Kevin, how far apart were these objects in this formation? And if you ask a lot of people, you know, how far apart do you think a formation would be? They would probably say, I don't know, 100 feet, 500 feet, quarter mile. The problem with these objects is they were tracking south in that formation was they were over 10 miles apart. And so, so a formation to someone that's watching it on radar is quite a bit different than how we would think. Like if we're in an air show, formation is they're wingtip to wingtip. But they were over 10 miles apart. That was a big sigh of relief for me because that was one of the few stumbling blocks I had to be able to say that a balloon could be the possibility. So here's where the balloon comes in and why it's still a possibility. When you launch the weather balloon, it bursts at 110,000 feet or so. That balloon will start coming down relatively fast. It's not going to come down at 0.78 seconds to cover that whole distance. That's a whole other story. But that object is coming down pretty quick. As it gets to about 30,000 feet, 25,000 feet in between that range, the parachute that's holding the radio sound package that sends out all the data is slowly opening up because it's hitting that thicker atmosphere. Mm-hmm. Same thing we see when we see a space capsule come back from space. You see the drogue chutes and it's dragging, and then the chute opens up and it's kind of like this. And then once it gets to that altitude, about 28,000 feet, it pops open, and all of a sudden the spacecraft slows down. Same thing happens with the balloons when they come down. That's when they do that. If they come down and they get into a crosswind, which is what was happening, I got the upper level air speeds for that day, and the winds from 28,000 feet in that area were tracking south at about 100 to 127 knots, the exact same speed that these objects were being tracked. So there's clue number one, or evidence number one, that, okay, well, it sounds like it's a balloon. And I sent you the upper level wind data too. I don't know if you can see it. It's one that has the yellow marks around it. So I looked at that. I said, okay, well, it's got to be balloons. But then I still had the other thing. These things don't travel in formations. And then that's when Kevin told me they're over 10 miles apart. That helped because it's over 10 miles apart explains the difference distance between the different weather stations. And all of the things that Kevin was seeing weren't necessarily coming from the NASA balloon test. He was seeing him at different times of the day. And so any balloon that would travel in that area was basically able to be picked up on Spy 1B. Sure. And so now he's seeing these objects, and the coincidence of these objects starting on the 10th, ending on the 16th, and never seen again. And then the balloon launches for the X-43 started on the 10th, ended on the 16th. Okay, well, that's a coincidence. And the upper level winds at 28,000 feet, which is the area where the balloon really, or the balloon's parachute package really takes over, and the object can drift at that point, happened to be between 100 and 120 some odd knots. That's exactly the speed that Kevin said that the objects were tracking south at, blah, 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 knots at 28,000 feet. The coincidence of all of these things being factored in and it not be a balloon is more of a stretch than to say that they were a balloon. So that for me was, okay, now I've got that problem solved. So then it shifted to the second scene. So first scene's handled. I got it. It's balloons. Okay, cool. Kevin didn't like that too much, but he's very, he's basically happy to figure out what it was. I mean, just like most of the guys, they just want to know what the hell it was. So when Fravor came up on that same area and he did not see anything, as they looked around, they saw some water disturbance. And he described it as being about the size of a 737. Something was under the water that was large that was causing that water to turn. And that turning of the water made him focus his attention to that location. And as he did, he saw an object. And the object, he described it as a oblong, white tic-tac-shaped object. I think Underwood claims that he's the one that actually coined the phrase, so he didn't get to call it tic-tac until after Underwood did. So he sees this object, and it's darting around, and as it's darting around, it's going, it's facing north-south, and it's moving in abrupt motions left and right, forward and back, but keeping the same orientation. And now I'm thinking again, okay, well, what possible other objects could this be other than, not necessarily other than something, I don't want to take something out of the mix, but what could it possibly be? Let me look at several things. And then I started digging in, and I started noticing, okay, we have Operation Silent Hammer down here. Okay, we got that. We got a lot of subs in the area that basically weren't supposed to be there. Fravor was tracked over to an area that was not necessarily in their true training area. It was like right at the fringe. So he may have been looking over into a different area where someone else was actually operating in to see their testing going on, which is effectively what seems to have happened. And so... you have this object darting around, and then Fravor decides to come down to check it out. As he starts to do his dive to the area, he's coming in from 20-some-odd thousand feet, and he's diving down. As he does, the object, according to him, essentially notices him and turns and then starts rising up itself. And he described the way it was rising up as a slowly kind of like a turning corkscrew. So he was trying to match that same thing. As he was coming down, this object was coming up, so that it was like they were doing a circle dance around each other. At about, I don't remember the exact altitude, but somewhere between 11,000-15,000 feet, or maybe 18,000. Fravor decides that that's enough of that, and he wants to get a closer look. So he basically put, you know, dips his nose, which causes the plane to bank, and dips his nose. He was able to speed up to cut that circle in half.
Yeah.
And as he did so, his description was the object appeared to be coming at him, and he lost it in the haze. The original way he stated it was it disappeared. He lost it in the haze. A couple other descriptions were different, but I'm not going to hold him to any of them. It kind of doesn't matter.
Sure.
But that was his experience at that moment, which according to Dietrich lasted about maybe 10 to 15 seconds. According to him, it's about 5 minutes. Somewhere in between is the real number, or, it makes sense that two people from two different perspectives will look at something in two different complete ways. So at that point, he's talking to Kevin. And Kevin's on the Princeton, and as they're going back and forth with the chatter, he reports that the object disappeared, blah, blah, blah. And then Teresa Ellers, which was she came on, I'm pretty sure it was her or someone else, saying she did the loadout call. Someone came on the radio and says, "Sir, you're not going to believe this, but that object is now at your cap point." And a cap point is basically an imaginary area in the air or space where people meet up.
It's your rally point.
Yeah, it's like a rally point or a waypoint. So you have that spot. And they said Kevin says it wasn't near the cap point. It was exactly on it, both altitude, latitude, longitude, and altitude. I mean, it's as close to it as you can get. That is still a quandary for me. So I'm not really sure on that one, but I don't have enough of other data to search for that one. So as that scene played out, Fravor and Dietrich, they looked around for a second and there's nothing there, and they were called back for fuel concern, and they come back and land on the ship. Now, as I'm analyzing this over the years, I'm finding little pieces of information here, little pieces of information there. But in 2019, I put out that I believe that object that Fravor saw was an ISR type balloon of some configuration. That's what I said way, way back 2019 or whatever it was. And because I had some other information, and I did have a source, but I couldn't reveal the source then. I'll reveal the source on the peer paper when I put it out. That information was something that basically told me that DARPA was there with the Air Force Research Laboratory doing testing on objects that can be launched from a submarine. Okay, great. Well, that doesn't tell me a whole lot, but it gave me enough to have an area to look at. As I look further into it, and the way it seems to be now, or the way it is, which is confirmed by actually to some degree by Tim Phillips himself. Tim Phillips actually ran the Arrow back in I can't remember the years he ran it, but ran it for a while. So you have this two canister launch system. A submarine will launch a canister, 21-inch wide canister, out of its torpedo tube. And this is one of the platforms that they can do it with. And the torpedo tube launches it out. The canister breaks the surface, opens up, and then out will come one or two objects. One is a drone, which will come out and scissor wing or whatever. And basically, once it gets airborne, it flies away and does what it's supposed to do. Not on a tether or anything like that. It's just the drone takes off. It goes to do what it's going to do. The problem with a drone as it flies low and near the surface of the ocean is that its transmissions will never make it back to the submarine. You can't just get good transmission through water. Yeah. So you have to have a secondary means of getting that information to the submarine. And so what happens is on the second canister, you have a two canister system. The second canister launches what's called an OTH-ISR. So you have an over the horizon ISR type balloon. And so it goes to the surface, breaks the surface. The balloon starts to inflate. It looks like an aerostat or what have you. So, which would definitely appear to be like a Tic Tac, but it remains tethered to the submarine while the systems are being checked out. And also because it's still being inflated. So once it gets through its inflation, pressure, then the tether's cut and then that balloon can go up to wherever it needs to go. Some of them are buoyancy layer pressurized balloons where they can actually maintain their altitude, and some are just throwaways. They just need something to relay the signal back down to the ship, to the submarine. So it'll basically either stay on station above the submarine or it's just released and that drone will go do its business and then either come back or not, depending on whatever the mission is. And so the drone transmits to the balloon transmits back down to the submarine because of OTH, which is over the horizon problems. So that basically kind of resolves the issue, but we don't have the exact platform. We do have some suspects, USS Georgia, which had just finished the Silent Hammer. We have Asheville, which probably didn't do it, but the Asheville was the one they used to do the DARPA testing on. And then you also have the third possibility of undersea platforms, which DARPA was testing at the time. And these platforms are where they mount them underwater, and once they go to release the canisters, they just let it go, goes to the surface, a lot of bubbles, same thing as a submarine, when a submarine's below the surface, and that's it. So you have scene B pretty much taken care of. Now everybody's saying, well, you haven't really proven anything, Mike. That's correct. I haven't proven anything yet until you actually see all the evidence that I have. So me just talking about it's not going to be enough, but I'm giving you this story of what's going on here. So what we have is some of the evidence that was brought to bear was Tim Phillips was being interviewed by Mick West. And during the interview with Mick West, Tim actually basically gave up some information that was extremely important to my investigation, which I appreciate, and credit to Mick West for that. And what he said was that, let me back this up just a little bit. The sailors that were on board the ship, not the pilots, but the sailors on the board the ship, they said that the ship was visited by some people in dark, flight suits or whatever, and they came and took away the data. There was a lot of contention. Yep. About whether or not that actually happened, because Fravor said it never happened. Well, it didn't happen to him, but apparently it did happen to quite a few other sailors. And by him saying that that never happened, it kind of like created a rift between the two sides or whatever, but that's whatever. So these guys have been going on for years saying, listen, someone came in and took our data, and there was no one there to do it. So I knew this had happened. And the story behind how I knew back in 2005, I was aware of this in a roundabout way, but that story is going to be for another day. But as far as this time frame, with Tim Phillips saying the following, essentially, I don't know if you got that video or not, but if not, don't worry about it. He basically said that one of his people was at a function. It was at a cocktail party. And the former head of DARPA, which I think I released his name in the paper, I'm not sure if I did or not. The former head of DARPA actually admitted at this party to the person that worked for Tim on Arrow that the DARPA personnel did in fact go out there, and in fact he said that the head of DARPA went out there and they did retrieve that data. So you have to ask yourself, if DARPA went out there to retrieve the data, the only reason why DARPA would come out to retrieve the data is if DARPA had something going on. And so what was going on was that they had testing going on of several classified programs that involves the launching of different types of ISR platforms from submarines. And this happened after Silent Hammer was over. They had a submarine that was lingering in the area. You know, and Georgia is the primary suspect for that. And with that happening, and some people see where the Georgia got home before November 20th or on November 24th. How could it make that transit? It can. We did the math on it, especially when you're trying to get your sailors home before Thanksgiving. But the important part was the fact that DARPA was there. DARPA admitted that they was there along with the, you know, Air Force, and that the personnel and that they were testing an ISR platform. Now, Tim said it was a WASP type setup, which part of it may have been, but my research is showing me that it's a little bit different than that platform, but it very well could have been. So you can bounce that back and forth. Doesn't matter. But the what matters is that now you've got two things happening at once that have been conflated together that started off a story that has continued to this day. So pull that aside, and now we go to scene C. After Alex, after Dietrich and Fravor get back to the ship, they go down, and of course, during the process of going back down for their briefing and stuff like that, everybody on the ship's talking about what was going on. And this became another area of contention, because back then there was not a reporting method for this type of situation that would not be taken seriously. You know, people would rib each other, and you get ridiculed. So a lot of times people back then did not necessarily want to report these things that were going on because of that, because you're going to be brought into that. They start playing, you know, Independence Day movies and stuff like this. And so that became, you know, a huge problem for them to do that. So as they went down to do the briefing, Fravor was able to meet up with Chad Underwood, who was the WSO, the WISO, for Paige's flight, mm-hmm. which is she was the pilot of the second, or he was pilot of the second sortie that went out, or the third, if you include Kurth. So Underwood is now, has a target on his aft-flare. And he's trying to box the target. Target's well beyond the range of what he's capable of doing. And while he's doing this, the object appears to dart off to the left. That has been analyzed so many times in so many different ways that the only way I can see that it actually occurred is the way I myself, McWest, and a whole bunch of others believe as well. Is that there was the zoom change that caused the object to look like it went off to the left. And now there's a lot of people that want to argue that one, but when you look at it frame by frame and you actually try to measure it and you look at it, you'll note as the object appears to move to the left, the zoom changes at exactly the same time. And the little bit of the delay for the camera to catch up to whatever's being shown on the screen accounts almost exactly for the difference between the object moving and then the screen responding. And then the camera kind of like loses lock, stays essentially in the same location that it is. Object goes off, and they don't pursue it anymore. They thought that it had taken off and, you know, like a bat out of hell, and there's no way to catch up to it or what have you. But we don't know that. That's a problem. We don't really have a lot of the story of what happened after this. We just know what happened during it, and then that's it. It's a minute and some odd seconds long video that we see, and we know there's more to that video. It's obviously clear, but there's enough information on that video to give me a good idea of what might be happening. So first off, the object, if it was a plane, now some of the other, I don't want to call us debunkers, but for lack of a better term, because people use that term, some of the debunkers out there say that was like an airliner or is another jet. Well, okay, I can agree with that. But which jet? You know, let's figure out which jet it was. And that's where it gets a little tricky. So there was a lot of video that I went through trying to match up that IR signature. So when you're looking at an object in infrared, it has glare that comes off the back of where the engine is, and other things. And at that distance, any object is going to resolve to a pill shape. So everything's going to look like a tic-tac at that distance. You're not really going to see a whole lot of lot of forms. And in the paper, it explains it a little better. But, go ahead.
And no. If you're looking at, because once again, the platform that you're talking about was specifically designed for submarine release. You know, this stealth encapsulation platform, the stealthy affordable capsule system, SACS, yep, is what it's SACS called. And I just had it up from Naval News. This article is coming out in 2005 about Northrop Grumman developing submarine launched AARGM ERs and AARGM XRs. Right. However, if you look, the part I have highlighted, Northrop Grumman's work on stealthy, affordable, capsulated systems dates back to 2002. It completed initial tests in 2003 that validated that the capsule's ability to release non-marinized UAVs. So they were releasing drones from these things from the ocean floor in 2003. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, on two different platforms. Either they actually, it's three different ways. One is a submarine. Go ahead.
When you look at it, like, here's an image of it right here. Like, that is a white capsule coming up out of the ocean.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
And no doubt if you've ever seen footage of something like that, like a cruise missile, within 5 to 10 seconds, typically the wings pop out, things start moving. But when you're talking about being in a fast-moving platform, well, once again, 5 to 10 seconds is the average length of a normal sighting of a UFO, period. So the idea that this pilot saw it for that long and then it disappeared in the haze, it may have disappeared in the haze because, hey, it suddenly achieved flight velocity coming out of the tube, wings launch out, and boom, there it goes.
No. Yeah, well, what Fravor saw is two different canisters. The first canister comes out, then the drone launches, and the drone will skim the surface of the water. Dietrich actually said that she saw what she thought was a missile-like object that went from, I think she said, right to left, depending on which direction they were looking. I can't remember if she said right to left or left to right, but she did. She said that she thought a missile-like object was going that way. And so that held true on that. So I was like, okay, well, let's figure out what the missile was. Well, that could have been the drone taken off. And then Fravor just witnessed, his eyes were fixed on the balloon because it was still attached to the submarine and being jerked around on that tether, which caused it to do all that darting ping pong ball thing back and forth. And that solved essentially that riddle. And as you move forward, that balloon meanders up. He basically crosses the pattern, and he may have burst that balloon when he got too close to it because of the vortex of the wings. All of this is kind of explained in the paper, because if I tried to explain that paper, it'd be like a 5-hour show. So that happened. I'm getting a warning on my thing here. I need to put the thing in, keep something on the screen for a second, and I will try to get this charging situation.
You better get it charged.
That's
just it. And this is what we have said the whole time, Mike, is that there is a world of sensor data. There is a world of things going on with this story that have not been told, that have not been sussed out. And this is why we state all the time, whenever we have MUFON on, whenever we have anybody from IUFOB on, been a long time for that, but
switch mics here.
Miss them. When it comes to anything, report to any and all, because your data may be hugely important in proving something or improving a trail of data, because like you said, there was this launch of simultaneously during this same window was the launch of the hypersonic experimental jet, the X-43, that required numerous days of balloon launch to get high atmospheric data, things like that.
And the coincidence of that happening exactly from November 10th to November 16th is just too much of a coincidence.
It's huge. And that is a massive swath of things. Once again, a massive swath of time for things to go over. So, it's interesting to see these things. And once again, to see it's been since 04, since the incident happened. It's been since 17, since the videos were released. It has taken you this long to assemble all of this data.
And all of this data,
like as I've been reading things throughout the day, I've been looking stuff up. I've been verifying this stuff. I've been like, there's a reason I'm popping up the things that I pop up. The reason I pop up the articles I pop up, folks, is because it is verification of what my guests talk about. And these were things that as I read through and combed through this document today, I made specific notes about these drone systems, about these weapons platforms, because once again, when you start marrying all of these things together, when you start marrying together the platforms for lasers and things like that that we know that were on them, when you start looking at even the infrared data from these sensor platforms and the way that those react to just general daylight, you know, there are errors. There are things that happen. There are wild things that happen and that appear on there that normally wouldn't if it was nighttime, you know.
Yeah, the time of day, temperature, location. And there's so many different factors that weigh into this that you have to take into account. One of the factors, which was a silly factor, but it was the research I was doing, was to try to get the Georgia from USS Georgia, hull number 729. I had to get it from San Diego to Norfolk, Virginia in 10 days. How in the world was that going to happen?
Yeah.
Because a normal cruise would be about 13 or so days. But I, in looking at it, I said, well, when was Thanksgiving? And Thanksgiving was the 25th. So, you know, and that ship can go quite fast. So if we wanted to keep the Georgia, you know, Georgia's still up in the air. It's not 100% until we get some of the logs back. But if it made that transit from November 14th to the 24th of to go to Norfolk, from San Diego to Norfolk, had to go through the Panama Canal, which is about a day delay there. It had to be moving pretty good at a pretty good clip, but it's definitely a possibility. Dave Beatty covers that in his upcoming documentary. So he has the same theory I have as far as a ship launch system, except he, you know, I don't, well, we'll just say that both of us have the same theory that a submarine was in the area that probably launched these canisters. Whether or not it was the Georgia, it remains to be seen until I get the logs to actually prove it.
Once again, if DARPA was working with them on these platforms, if they were working with them on these assets that they want to hide on the sea bottom, stuff like that, then, it would make sense why people in DARPA Black showed up and took sensor data and took tapes.
And that was so key. That little piece of information was so important. Because I knew DARPA had something to do with it. I knew the Air Force had something even to do with
it. We've said it the whole time.
For a long time, but I had zero. I had nothing to bring to the table. Basically, just me saying something and a couple of people selling me something, but I can't throw them under the bus.
Saying it. Like, this just logically seems to line up with some kind of unknown test.
But when you have the head of one agency saying that the head of another agency admitted being there and taking the data off the ships, that's kind of unprecedented. That just doesn't happen.
Yeah.
So a lot more has been made of it, but it does happen. It just doesn't happen to the magnitude that it did for that testing.
Let's get into real quick, because we've got you for a few more minutes. I don't want to keep you too long. We've gone past the hour. However,
that's fine.
There's a few more important points. And one of the important points that I want to bring up is the forward-looking infrared camera and what these are used for. These are used as kind of a point of triangulation for weapons systems, folks. They are not made as a point of precision optics. They are not made as a point of, you know, precision data gathering in that kind of way. It happens to be that we can record off of them. Like you said, it's basically Super 8 film that they're using to record off of these things. It's like old data tape that they're using to record off these platforms. So it's not like, hey, here's your thumb drive of 4K footage. This is basically used in addition to other laser systems as a baseline to be able to go hot object, hotter object, aim at the hotter object. That's what it's for. It's for an initial swath of data for a missile to begin tracking as it drops down. From there, more precise systems take over and stuff like that. But that is the initial use for these forward infrared camera pods and these forward infrared looking cameras for weapon systems. It happens to be that we can record off of them.
And
that's important to know.
Yeah, the AFLIR basically stands for Advanced Forward-Looking Infrared. And that platform sits on the left chin of an F-18. So the fuselage of the F-18, and if you're sitting in the pilot seat to your left and below you is going to be where your AFLIR pod is. And so that AFLIR pod has a gimbal on the front of it that moves around and can lock on targets or whatever and that whole system is hooked into the entire battle group system through what's called Link 16. So it brings in the data. Infrared imagery is not normally as high resolution as say some of the other, but you can see where he was dialing through TV mode, infrared mode, white hot, black hot. He was thumbing through to try to get a better picture, because if you look at the right side of the screen, it will show RNG 99.9. And what that is saying to me or to any, a pilot is that the object is beyond the ability for the AFLIR to determine the actual range. So it just says, okay, I can't do it.
Yeah.
The AFLIR ranges an object two or three ways. The first way it has is laser. You can just fire a laser at it and go, okay, you're blah, blah, blah away.
Yeah.
But you don't necessarily want to do that, give away your position, because you got an exact line that points right back to where you are.
Yeah.
So the other way is optically inside. The AFLIR is different than say the regular flares you see on some of the other ones like Lightning and some of the other ones. And then it has a single optical tube. And inside that optical tube, it has the apparatuses that move around to basically adjust for horizontal lock to keep the horizon, stable. So as you turn, the whole thing doesn't turn. And that kind of helps as you're a pilot. You don't want chasing one thing over here is where your gyroscopes go over here, and then this thing over here is going the other way, and it's a little confusing. That's called situational awareness. So you want to make certain that you're aware of everything going around you, and you don't want any of your instruments confusing you. So with that being said, on that setting, it actually measures the distance to an object based on how it focuses it. And so if you have a camera and you focus your camera's lens and then you look at the lens, you'll see the distance to the object essentially by looking at your lens. It kind of tells you, okay, objects will be in focus that are, say, 30 some odd feet away. Sometimes you'll see that on your lens. That's actually what that setting's for. It's your focal length. And so that's how they were able to try to determine how far away the object was, but the object was well beyond the range. You can tell by the fact it's super fuzzy.
Yeah.
That it's well beyond the range of what that AFLIR was doing. So that's why it looks the way it does. He changed the zoom to zoom in and out to get a better picture of it. And that's done internal to the AFLIR through the medium or wide band view angle down to what's called narrow. At that narrow band, that's when you can actually just say, okay, we have X number of pixels across the screen, and we can actually measure the size of the object as far as radians are concerned. And this gets into a lot of funky math to determine essentially the size of the object at a distance if we knew roughly what the distance was. That's how we were able to do go fast and all of that stuff.
Yeah.
But this is different because it was out of the range. And I was looking through hundreds, literally hundreds of different videos, trying to find another object that looked at least similar to what I was seeing here. Nothing. I was like, wow, I'm stumped on this one. And then one day, Dave Fouts, I have to give credit to Dave Fouts on this one. He found he took a video himself or found one. I can't remember if he did it or whatever, but he's a depot level tech for FLIR. He has never worked on AFLIR. But he at least worked on FLIR. So some of his information is usable. Some of it may not apply to what we're doing. But one of the videos he had was of an F-18 that had just taken off and was making a slight bank to the left. And I, when I looked at that, I said, wow, that looks just like the Tic Tac video. And, you know, my mind's now playing with me. So then I'm thinking, okay, let me not do confirmation bias here. Let me put the two side by side and look at them side by side. And from a more of an analytical standpoint, now I know the video he had, because he was so much closer, it's going to be a lot clearer. So I have to look for the other indicators that say, okay, these two objects are similar or they're dissimilar. The objects match or they don't match. And what I was getting was that this object was probably an F-18. Now I got another quandary. One question leads to another. Okay, so if it's an F-18, that is the video that we see that we know is Tic Tac, I'm now thinking in my mind, holy crap, it's just an F-18.
Yeah.
But all the F-18s were accounted for. There were no missing F-18s. There was no F-18 that was past where Underwood was at that time. Nothing. So my theory went right out the window. And then I thought for another moment, let me go back and look at that X-43 launch again. And I go back, and as I'm looking at it, I see a plane flying right next to the B-52 as it's taking off and takes the X-43 out. And guess what it is? An F-18. It's an F-18 flying in this basically same area that they were. And I'm thinking, well, this is interesting. Let me explore this a little bit more. And as I did, I come to find out that the NASA has several F-18s, but for that particular launch, they had two white NASA F-18s were flying for the X-43, which happened on the 14th. But Mike, he was, you know, this object, the launch for the X-43 was on the 16th. And then they originally tried to launch it on the 15th, but then they moved it to the 16th. And this happened on the 14th. You're wrong. Well, I thought again, well, let me get some more information to see what's going on here. So NASA had the F-18s trade off. Each day, one would go out to do the upper level wind checks because the balloons go up at 1,000 feet per second. So they're out of there pretty quick, but they get the measurement of key areas that they need to go focus on to see how an actual aircraft is going to act in that area. Yeah. So guess what they do? They send an F-18 out there. That F-18 is more like a civilian thing. It doesn't have IFF on it, so it doesn't have your friend or foe indicator. Mm. And it doesn't fly with the Link 16, so it's not going to be on the inventory of the Nimitz or the Reagan group. Keep in mind, the Reagan was out there, too. A lot of people don't know that. You know, so you have these two carrier groups out there with a whole bunch of F-18s, all of them using Link 16, and all of the F-18s were accounted for. So I had to find where this F-18 came from. It came from NASA. NASA had two F-18s, of which days leading up to that point, they would fly. Now, most researchers would stop at that point and say, okay, here's enough information. Let me go try to find the logs, blah, blah, blah. Not me. I call the pilot. I called the chase pilot. I got him on the phone. I called his wife answered first the day before, and he was out. And so he came back the next day. His name is Dana Purifoy. And so I talked to Dana, and I said, listen, I said, I got a situation here. It's going to sound really out there, and I'm going to sound like a quack on the phone, but let me explain. And so while I'm talking to him, he's saying, wow, this is pretty interesting. I said, yeah. I said, you might be one of the most famous pilots in the world, not even realizing it. He goes, yeah, this is kind of cool. He says, but let me check my logs. So he checks his logs, and lo and behold, it was not him. It's the other guy. So Dick Ehrers is the other pilot, and so he was flying the other F-18, and they switched off every day. So on the day in question, it seems that his name's Richard, but he goes by Dick. Dick Ehrers was the other pilot. And that may be the very person that you see. So, and the reason why I'm so adamant about it being an F-18 is because after watching the two things side by side, the flight characteristics, in fact, it was doing almost exactly the same thing that, the same speed, same altitude that the F-18 was that Underwood was in. It just all fit together. And so once all of these three scenes started coming together, they basically also at the same time were pulled apart, because you have three separate events that happened at three separate locations essentially. You had the multiple day locations that happened to Kevin Day that were, you know, the balloons over time. You had the Spy-1B radar that can now see these objects over, you know, that they couldn't see before. So they had the fidelity. They even turned the radar off, turned it back on. The fidelity was even better. They were seeing these objects even better. So they had to be real objects. And they were. They were real objects. You know, and then you said they had the objects Kevin Day was saying they were coming in from space. The reason for that, I'll be real quick on this one. The radar system that he had was set to air intercept mode. That's the intercept mode is the mode you set your thing to when you have an aircraft in your sky there. So Kevin could not see an object that would be dropping directly from overhead. That would not show up. It would be immediately discredited or basically taken out like clutter. So the only time he got to see them is when they stopped and then started drifting south at 28,000 feet at whatever miles per hour, you know, or knots or whatever. So 100 to 120 knots, which is exactly the same as the wind speed. So you have that. So he was told that 0.78 second situation of the object flying. That was from ballistics the next day. He got that calculation the next day.
Well, and something important to note, especially because once again, sensor platform, radar, sensor operator, radar operator. Dude knows what he's doing, but it's a new system. And here's the thing about that new system. Can balloons be seen by radar? Yes. It's normally their payloads and packages that are seen by radar, unless they are like mylar or metallic in some way. The material that most balloons are made of, the polymer and things like that, is too transparent to radar for conventional radar at your local airport, weather radar, things like that. It's going to pass right through it, and it's going to pass right through it on purpose. It's going to consider that, quote, clutter. The system's designed to get rid of clutter. The system that was just installed, that they hadn't calibrated and hadn't learned to use in that kind of way, was designed to show you that clutter. Just in case it's something to pay attention to. Yep. So the fact that they were seeing these balloons on their radar system in that kind of way was new, period.
Yeah. And that same thing happened with Roosevelt, too. Roosevelt was seeing objects. Remember, if you see Ryan Gray says, we saw them every day for 2.5 years. Well, if you see objects every day for 2.5 years.
That's not an anomaly.
No one seems to care about it. Then that's a problem, too. But that's going to be a whole other case we'll talk about later. But to finish, you know, this thing up with the radar too is, you know, Kevin is very passionate about what he does, and he had, you know, he's had a lot of situations happen to him that obviously will keep private or whatever, but he's gone through a lot. In other words, and it became extremely important to me because he told me he wanted to know what it was. He didn't care what it was. He just wanted to know what it was. And I said, you know what, Kevin, I'm going to try to do that for you. So I'm going to try to figure out what it was. It may not agree with a lot of people. A lot of people are probably sitting there watching this going, and that's a big pill to swallow. It is a big pill to swallow. I get it. But keep in mind, it took me 9 years to piece this puzzle together. It's actually 7 years. It just took the last 2 years to start cleaning up the mess as far as trying to narrow everything down, because I couldn't come to you and just say, oh, it's a balloon, without having something to give you. So each scene has its own separate individualized evidence to support that scene. And that is going to go into a paper. That paper is going to be put out for peer review. Everybody can look at it. And if something needs to be changed on it, like we get new information down the road. But I put this into Grok, I put it into Gemini, I put it into ChatGPT, and I said, listen, here's the information I have. Here's the evidence that supports what I'm trying to say. How does this rank as far as anything? And each individual AI that I fed that into said to date, it's the best and most accurate, depiction as to what probably occurred that day as far as being a prophetic explanation.
And, you know, it goes to show the fact of how long an investigation can take. Because even now, Mike, the story ain't over. This doesn't close the books. This is just hypothesis. It's an amazing hypothesis on numerous situations because, that's always been the argument about that week long of activity, is it was numerous events over a week. You know, right. But when you start breaking them down in the way that you do and showing the evidence of NASA flights and balloons and radar systems that weren't able to see those balloons, but now they can and hadn't been briefed on all of the new capabilities. Putting forth these things, putting forth these questions is what is important, because that's the only way. Other than that, and here's the question, folks. Once again, this does not remove anybody's experience. It doesn't remove what happened to anybody in the air. Doesn't remove what Kevin Day felt when he saw those sensors go off, when he saw that stuff happen. Like he said, he doesn't care. He just wants, because he's a sensor dude. His sensors went crazy and he can't explain why, you know, at least he didn't know why. And if you can tell him why, that's awesome, because he'd like to know. And here are some quite possible answers to these questions that have been floating around for quite literally the last 20 years almost, man. Like when I started looking at all of this, like I said, deep diving into the document and pulling things up and looking at things and looking at carrier groups and what weapons platforms people had and when they were making them. And hey, look at that. There's a whole class of submarines made specifically to launch these things. Like, like the entire Ohio class of subs was made around this technology. Interesting. So, it is fascinating and it is great. And it is an amazing amount of information that you have put into this document, man. And it's one of those, the case is still open, like you said. But this is a great trail of data that can be gone down in real investigative fashion that can lay out some possibilities.
And I appreciate feedback from anyone.
Absolutely.
You know, not the feedback that says, oh, he's a trained observer. You're an idiot for telling me you can't tell the difference.
You're a trained observer, too. You're a trained investigator.
And I'm a director of photography and astronomy and telescopes and lenses. So I might, I don't know. But you've got that. And I get it. I fully get it. No one wants to look at someone that's basically considered a hero and go, hey, you made a mistake. No, he didn't make a mistake. He reported what he saw.
Absolutely.
Came back, and that was it. That's in his mind. He was done. He was over it. And then all of a sudden it came back, you know, because he had Cheech out there doing his thing. This all sort of came back. The reason why it came back for me is because it ties into a telephone call I had way back in 2005. And it validated that for me. So I stayed on this case. And I'm going to stay on it and see it all the way through to the end. Right now, the next things I have to do is get the actual flight logs from a couple of NASA F-18s, and I'm trying to get those in. It's kind of hard because they're not like it's not like an official civilian type flight log, or military is kind of in the middle. And it's a little harder to get. So I'm going for that. There's a couple other pieces of information I'm going to be piecing together with the final paper. Once the final paper goes out, then we'll be able to do the graphics and the video and all that other stuff, so that you don't just see my boring face sitting here trying to explain something to you, because it's hard. It's a hard pill to swallow. It's a hard thing to track because so many different things were going on. It's extremely difficult to keep that together in your head and go, okay, I can picture that. I can pick. Well, now I can't picture it over here. And now we got them saying this over here, because everybody remembers like watching Dave Beatty's Nimitz encounter. So you remember that. And so that's playing in your head what the pilot said. And if you read the original report, all that plays together and it gets, cloudy. It's real cloudy.
Well, and that's just it. You know, documents like this really do help lay out the data points, because that is that is what's important beyond. And, you know, the encounters, the testimonies are important as well. You know, no doubt. Absolutely. But once again, beyond the people that were operating a machine at the time, there was a person like me sitting there in front of screens whose job it was to look at data coming in from sensors and make sense of that. And that's what you've done, is look at the data that came in from sensors, look at the data from weather balloons, look at the data from various ships in the area. all publicly available, all this stuff available through FOIA requests, things like that. So kudos to you, Mike, for putting this together. Thank you so much for coming on, for always coming on and breaking these things down, because it is a thick topic. It's a long topic. You know, once again, folks, we're looking at almost 20 years, and better than 20 years since the event happened. So details get fuzzy. People's memories get fuzzy, things like that. What doesn't get fuzzy is the data that was recorded, the data that was there, the data that can be found. And good on you for digging it up, Mike. Good on you for piecing these things together in red string fashion, man, because there's a lot. And if you aren't aware of these weapons platforms, then you may not be aware of other literal elements that may have been at play. So thank you for that. Let everybody know where they can go to. I'll let them know where they can find the document. The document's available on our website. But where can they go to follow you, follow the work of 5x5 News, everything else, man? I know you have some exciting stuff in the shoot.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. Well, first off, we'll start the podcast back up again probably in a week or two. I'm in the so-called studio now as we're trying to piece some of this together. I was hoping to have a little bit of it tonight, but I said, let me debut it when I come out.
From the truth bunker.
Yeah, exactly. From the truth tron. So, sometimes you see a word, you go, I don't remember using that word before, and then it becomes the new word of the day. Ontological is one of the buzzwords the last few months.
But, Turber's bunker of truth.
The turbo truth. If you want to follow me on something where everything's more timely, that would probably be on X. Just look for 5x5 News on X. He's got a link, I'm sure, in there. That will be where I have the most up-to-date information, because the other platforms, I pretty much have to formulate it into some sort of video or whatever. Yeah. And that way there you can actually see the arguments that go back and forth, you know, all the fun stuff, all the physicists versus the armchair quarterbacking and all this other stuff. It's fun to watch. Another way is to look on YouTube, especially if you're looking back for the Las Vegas shooting information from that investigation. That's there. I'll probably have a wrap up of that because next year is this 10-year anniversary, and next year is this 10-year anniversary for this. So my last quarter for next year is being planned out right now.
We definitely need to have you on a couple of shows as the year closes out, my friend, in October as well as December. So
The documentary it's already basically started. We're doing the preliminary works for that. So that's going in, and that'll be for this. I will have an interview with I don't know if I can release it yet, but we'll just say a large book company that everyone will know when it comes out. We'll be here on Friday, and we'll be going into the Las Vegas shooting on that. And then we're going to go into the UFO part. Yeah. So it's going to be pretty interesting because it's two different things I've been trying to knock out for years. We're going to pretty much get that groundwork going on Friday. So I'm happy about that. So
I'm excited for you.
Thank you, buddy. Well, hey, and appreciate you. You've been there since the beginning, and I appreciate that. It's always good to be on your show. Always have a good time.
Same, man. Always here for support. Any help you need on this document, renderings, whatever, don't hesitate to reach out to a brother. We'll see what we can do to help you out.
Sounds good, buddy.
All right. You take care, man. We'll talk to you soon. Links inbound. Take care, bud.
Thank you, bro. Take care.
Man. Always an amazing conversation with Mike Turber, folks. It is fascinating to sit back and think once again that we are coming up. 2004 is when the Nimitz encounter occurred. 2017 is when we heard about it. We are rapidly approaching that anniversary of 10 years. And what does the conversation mean? Are we ready to look at data in another right? You know, right now, I need to contact them and see if we will be going, but coming up is the 25th year of the 9/11 incident. And that's what I kept saying at the conference last year with them, was that at 25 years, I think people are ready to hear a little bit of hard truth that may have been there in that kind of right. So hopefully truth can come about in these ways. Hopefully we can get truth. And speaking of truth, when we come back from this quick commercial break, everybody, make sure to stay tuned. We will be joined by our good friend John Hall. We will be talking about the truth behind MK Ultra, the things that were revealed in the recent MK Ultra panel with the Senate. And things that may be revealed later, and even where the technology is now. Are you watching us on an MK Ultra technology as we speak? So we'll be talking about that and so much more with our good friend John Hall right after this.
The key to good science is good research. At the heart of good research is a good data set. With the Field Observation and Encounter Log from Curious Research, you can easily keep track of your investigative information all in one place, making it easier to review cases and readily see comparisons and contrasts between them. Whether out in the woods squatching, in a back room gathering EVPs, or using high-tech gear to track UFO-UAP activity, this easy-to-carry, pocket-sized scientific data log is the perfect companion for any field researcher. You can find your copy of the Curious Research Field Observation and Encounter Log at Amazon.com or visit the official Curious Realm store at CuriousRealm.com/store to reserve your copy for yourself, your family, or a mind that you want to open. That website again is CuriousRealm.com/store.
Well, hello, everybody, and welcome back from that quick commercial break. Thank you so much for staying with us. Also, thank you so much to our sponsors, especially True Hemp Science. If you're a user of CBD products like I am, stop on by True Hemp Science today. TrueHempScience.com is your source for amazing CBD products. Christopher Lynch and True Hemp Science use the Spigeric process, where every part of the hemp plant is used. That's every part. Seeds, stems, buds, leaves, roots, every part is used, combusted, and reused, and that process followed time and time again until nothing remains but an amazing Spigeric product. Stop on by, check them out. TrueHempScience.com is the website that you want to go to. Curious7 is the code that you want to use to save 7% off your entire cart of $50 or more. While you are online, make sure to stop on by CuriousRealm.com/video, folks. Right there is our embedded YouTube links. We have tons of pages. Our good friend Mike Turber is embedded there. Upcoming guest Paradigm Research Group, Steve Bassett, all kinds of stuff. But the one you want to pay attention to is right here. It's a playlist that we have on our YouTube that is nothing but declassified government panels. This is all kinds of stuff, including what we're talking about tonight. Most of these panels I have also gone through and actively screen captured and recorded so that should they disappear, they still exist somewhere. But I'm very glad to welcome back our good friend, Dr. John Hall tonight. We will be talking about the new MK Ultra panel that just happened. The original was delayed. I was supposed to be on, I was on Jeremy Scott's Into the Paranormal talking about it while I was in Vegas. And it was sad that it was delayed. And it was interesting because there was an entire box of documents that was taken from Tulsi Gabbard's office.
Yep.
So, welcome back to the show, Doctor. How have you been?
Oh man, good. I'm glad to be back, Chris. Yeah, I was kind of surprised that this actually came to fruition, actually.
And why is that? Why are you surprised to see this coming to fruition, especially now?
Well, I mean, when they stole the documents prior to the initial date, when it was supposed to be, then I kind of thought, you know, well, I mean, that was probably a shot across the bow, you know, to maybe just, you know, maybe have a hearing on something else like potholes or, you know, civil stuff or something.
Yeah. Another drone hearing.
Yeah. I mean, because they're not, you know, they're not, they probably don't really want a lot of this exposed. Even though most of it, from what I saw, what was talked about is kind of stuff that was first to some extent already known, at least known by those of us that have been talking about it for 20 years.
Well, and that's just it, you know, and we were talking about this before the recording here. And this is something that I've been saying about the UFO UAP files, because there are people in the communities that are very, very upset, Doctor. And what I have to keep reminding them is while we've been hip deep in this topic for 20 plus years of our life, I'm 50 years old. I know I've known you and the world of targeted individuals for at least the last 15 years of my life, you know, right at. And I've known of the term and things like that. That's how I knew I'd heard of the term and that kind of stuff beforehand. So a lot of these things I have been looking into and researching for better than half of my life almost. So there's a good cadre of the population, though, probably 60%, that even though they may believe in UFOs, even though they may believe in conspiracy theories like MKUltra, they don't understand the fact that they're real. They don't understand the fact that, like, no, we've already had hearings on this. And
maybe the take home from this will be that it's still going on, you know, because that was, you know, the problem. I'll tell you a little bit of the problem I had with the whole thing. Well, Marco Rubio and I have talked about this when Havana Syndrome broke, and they kind of found me, and, you know, they found out about the books and they found out about my presence at the bioethics commission's hearing. I guess that was the 2000, hard to believe, but 2016. Yeah. So I had already reached out to me when all of that broke, and believes it, by the way. I mean, he is one of the good guys that does believe it and does pretty much believe that people have been experimented on. The problem is that nobody within the government that's supposed to be overseeing the CIA and the NSA and other unnamed intelligence agencies are involved, really knows how to enforce any oversight. But that being said, so then when this got planned on the initial date, I was reached out to and asked if I could round up the papers that I had written and that I had presented to the Bioethics Commission and sent them in. And I mean, not to pat myself on the back or anything or blow my own horn, but kind of was halfway expecting that maybe they would have asked me to be there, you know, after getting my documents. But that didn't happen, which kind of, after it got canceled the first time, kind of I was thinking, well, you know, it's probably not going to be rescheduled. But then I think they intentionally rescheduled it at, like, what was it, like 2 p.m. on a weekday or something. And, you know, which, you know, I don't know how many people would have been viewing it live at that time.
Yeah, it was like 8 a.m. on Tuesday.
Yeah.
And I mean, like 8 a.m. It was, or 9 a.m. It was 9 a.m. Eastern, 8 a.m. Central.
Yeah.
Because I remember I tuned in and I thought it was hip deep in. Little did I know that the stream didn't start. Just so you know, folks, if you go to the website, if you go to our link, that actual panel doesn't start till like 17 minutes in. There's just a holder slide for 17 minutes. So though I thought I was coming in 20 minutes late, I was only coming in like past the opening salvos. But they got into a lot of stuff. And some of what we're going to talk about tonight is things that we've talked about for years, man. The idea of, we no longer need chemicals. You don't need somebody strapped to a chair with an IV drip of LSD or with gaseous LSD around them. You don't need that. You don't need radio waves even. They get into the fact of, was Project Mockingbird carried on through social media? Has Project Mockingbird and the idea of how do you mass convert a population? Because that was the whole object of Project Mockingbird, was how do we go like behind the lines in Cambodia and convert these people before our soldiers come across the line? You know, how do we convert the true believer? And buddy, it gets into Charles Manson and why was he allowed to operate as kind of a soft experiment? And even the fact of, Charles Manson had done federal time before he moved to San Francisco. So he was actively under he was on probation with a federal officer. His petty theft of vehicles alone should have sent him back to federal prison, much less the charges of rape. But all of that was allowed to happen. And it was basically like, let's see what somebody can do with the population of young people and a whole bunch of drugs.
Well, I will give credit to Representative Luna for at least actually having the stones to even call for the hearing. I mean, because she's obviously putting herself at risk, you know, not just politically, but I mean, putting her life at risk.
Yeah.
Doing that. I just kind of, when they asked for my documents, you know, unfortunately, there's only a couple of us that are still kind of blowing the horn for this thing. And that, you know, Robert Duncan's passed away. Fred Bell's passed away.
Yeah.
Two of the other players that kind of in that, Dr. Terry Robertson has kind of backed out of it, you know. And when they asked for my documents, or Jesse Beltran, he's still kind of going around and blowing the horn.
Yeah.
Well, none of us were actually asked to be there, you know, and we're the ones that have kind of mostly been dealing with the public version of Havana syndrome.
Well, and I think that we will get to that. Fortunately, I think that we're going to get to that right now. I mean, we've already got, and that is what I think brought a lot of MK Ultra back up in the public eye and in the interest of this, which is specifically a panel. This is the same panel of people that's handling the UFO whistleblowers, everything else. And the title of the panel is the panel to declassify government secrets. Like that is the overall name of the panel, and the movement there is the idea, how do we begin declassification of these secrets and these documents that, like, they've just found another trove. And once again, it's interesting because when it ended, when the church committee happened and we found out about MK Ultra and the associated projects, MK Naomi, Operation Artichoke, both of those had to do with how do you erase somebody's mind? How do you reprogram somebody's mind? Artichoke specifically, an army program on how do you create somebody that is a willing, complicit killer without their knowledge even. And all of this had to do with, A, we have to break the brain before we can rebuild the brain. Yeah. So how do we break the brain? And that's what these two doctors who've written these books, Poisoner in Chief and the other, mainly about Charles Manson. And that's just it. I think we're getting to the point now where people can, A, it's no longer conspiracy theory. We know that MK Ultra happened. We know that this happened. We are now finding new documents. Even one of the witnesses here says that he came across a whole trove of documents at UCLA.
If you remember about 15 years ago, I guess now, on another show that you used to produce, you know, I actually made the comment. Somebody said, "Well, where do you see this ending?"
Yeah.
And I said, if the government does what they usually do in the past, it'll be 40 years down the road after pretty much all of us that really blew the horn trying to warn people about this are gone. And then they'll have a hearing, and then the State Department will put out an apology to everybody that was experimented on.
Yeah.
And then the technology will become commonplace.
Yeah. And that's part of what they get into in the later part is why now, you know, why this long? And a lot of it is, shame on behalf of the government, shame on behalf of members of the CIA that were part of funding it. Shame on behalf even of the unwitting, because there were tons of universities. They get into the fact that there were no less than 149 known sub-programs, 149, and these were all funded. These were all black budget funded, where they had shell corporations attached to them that would have passed documentation check, like going to universities, going to medical facilities, things like that.
And
researching on people.
TCU and University of Texas in Austin were two of the big players here.
Absolutely. And hey, man, you're right there in the backyard of the Air Force base, right there where experiments happened with military prisoners, with people in the psych ward, all kinds of stuff. So let's hear really this first clip here. Dr. Kisner talking about that new MK Ultra concept. Let's see. This is about 29 minutes in. Hey, where's the audio at? I promise I had it queued. Hold on. Let me get that figured out real quick. Ah, I see what's happening. Hold on, folks. Give me just a second. So many buttons, so many things, so many windows. So, if you go to curiousrealm.com/videos, that is where you can find the link to the Mind Control and Accountability, Uncovering the Truth of the CIA's MK Ultra Project. And we're just going to scrub forward here to about 29 minutes when he is talking about this.
I would also point out that in addition to searching for unknown documents, this committee could do a tremendous service by simply asking for the end of redactions on the documents that we now have. There are reams of documents about MKUltra that have heavy sections redacted. In the 1970s, this was justified by the argument that it had only been 20 years since these terrible things had happened and revealing details might affect national security. Now 70 years have passed. That argument can no longer be valid. So I would urge this committee to try to fill out all the blank spaces in the documents that we have.
And there's once again that plea for let's start unredacting the files that we do have. Because, yeah, there are tons of names in there, tons of names of associations, different doctors, all kinds of things that have passed. It's okay. You know, we can name names now.
No, and I'll tell you somebody, the other person that they wrote a great book using all of those redacted documents was Colin Ross. You know, he's a psychiatrist here in Texas that wrote the original book, Bluebird, Atrocities Committed by American Psychiatrists. Excellent book on MKUltra. And from what I understand, I don't think he was included in any of this either. And he was one of the first people to actually go through all of those redacted documents and kind of was able to discern which universities were involved and were black budgeted in their research.
Well, and that's just it. And they get into number one, how hard it would be to get victim names, especially from HIPAA records. That would be almost impossible. But there may be some like he said later on, you know, through his research into his books and stuff like that, he found documents hidden away at UCLA that were part of private archive, all kinds of things that were not part of the slash and burn to get rid of it, because that's just it. The whole process to begin with of MKUltra was a slash and burn operation to begin with. It was, how do we get rid of evidence? How do we dump the evidence? By the time we had it, we had maybe 150 pages of good stuff. But that 150 pages laid out a lot.
And most of the original 150 pages that didn't get shredded by Alan Dulles was mostly financial records.
Exactly.
But the financial records is what led back to which universities were involved and kind of where the money was coming from.
Yeah.
You know, and then of course there were some people that were saying, well, you know, were those fabricated you know, to give a false trail. But as it turns out, that they didn't. It was just records that they missed. They were in a different building than the ones that they originally took. As far as HIPAA, I don't know if HIPAA would even apply. I mean, because you're talking about people, a lot of whom were there, for one, HIPAA didn't exist at the time that happened. And the other is you're talking about experimentation that was done under a black budget with no known IRB. And IRB, just for your listeners, IRB stands for Institutional Review Board. You know, anytime you're experimenting on the public, let's say it's a pharmaceutical company, there has to be an IRB. The IRB is public. Their records are public. And it's supposed to abide by the Hippocratic Oath and, you know, no harm done. Of course, with any experimentation, you know, vaccines or whatever, there may be harm. But I mean, I'm not so sure that there would be any HIPAA violation of digging up victims.
Yeah. Yeah. And specifically digging up victims, they get into the CIA house that existed in Germany and possible bodies that are buried there, that Der Spiegel got into with all kinds of stuff. And those are interesting reports to read, you know. So let's hear about this second part with Manson and things like that.
Read a story about murders committed by a group of hippies called the Manson family. For those unfamiliar with this horrific episode of American history, in the summer of 1969, four young people acting on the orders of a cult leader named Charles Manson went to the home of movie director Roman Polanski and murdered everyone they found there, including his 8.5-month pregnant wife, the actress Sharon Tate. The victims were complete strangers to their killers. The following night, Manson's followers murdered another couple in the same grisly fashion. At the time I accepted the assignment, I'd never heard of MKUltra, and I wouldn't for another 2 years after I'd missed countless deadlines, lost the assignment, and fallen down a nightmarish rabbit hole trying to answer the question I couldn't quite shake. How had Manson, a barely literate ex-con, acquired the ability to persuade ordinary young people to murder complete strangers simply because he had told them to? The pursuit of the answer to that question led me to Dr. Louis Julian West, known to his friends as Jolly. West was one of the most influential psychiatrists in America. During his career, he crossed paths with some of the most controversial events of the 20th century, including the Patty Hearst kidnapping case and the aftermath of the John F. Kennedy assassination investigation. In 1977, West was one of seven academic researchers named in a front-page New York Times story alleging that the CIA had used American universities, hospitals, and prisons as secret laboratories for experiments involving LSD and other drugs on unwitting human subjects. West vigorously denied the allegations. He acknowledged that the agency had approached him, but insisted he had refused because he said LSD was too dangerous and unpredictable to be used on humans. He added that he limited all of his research with LSD to animals. The revelations in the Times led directly to the congressional hearings held later that year. West's denials, however, were effective. He was never investigated, and his name never came up at the hearings. I'll spare you the long and tedious story of how my Manson reporting led me to West, except to say that I eventually learned that in 1967, when Manson transformed into the cult leader we are familiar with today, he and his followers were receiving free medical care at a clinic in San Francisco, where West had established a base of operations for a research project he was conducting nearby.
Oh, well, how about that?
Yeah. and just so your listeners know, Dr. Jolly and West, actually, when he passed away with a glowing eulogy and was seen as one of the pioneers of American psychiatry. So as well as several other very popular named psychiatrists of the time that were involved with MKUltra.
Well, and that's just it, you know, literally they amounted this stuff to war crimes, to crimes against humanity. It is referenced later that the operation, what was it? Operation Midnight Seduction that they had going on in San Francisco, which was basically just like a brothel, a speakeasy brothel that the CIA had set up where, and they were like, there was zero scientific protocol. The people watching the so-called experiment were not scientists. You know, it was just some dude sitting there watching somebody tripped out on LSD being asked questions and then seduced and then blackmailed by the CIA.
Yeah.
and that's just messed up to know that, hey, they ran a front brothel like that. Those that were working, the sex workers, were put through that. They were put through, experimentation. They were given drugs, all kinds of things.
Well, that's the same thing they did in Guatemala. They took, syphilis infected prostitutes, and put them in the prisons there with prisoners to, when they were researching basically a weaponized version of syphilis. That's the one that Hillary Clinton had to come forward and apologize for, that initiated the Bioethics Commission hearings under Obama. That, of course, in the end of the day, after multiple meetings and a bunch of people, I mean, I was present at one of them, came to the conclusion that no ongoing non-consensual experimentation is happening in the United States.
Yeah.
You know, and then of course it turns out that the woman that was heading that actually was, you know, complicit as well.
Because it's not happening here, much like in any gain of function technology. It's been gladly outsourced long ago. Yeah. It happens at places like Abu Ghraib.
In Ukraine.
That's where we test it now. Places like the Ukraine at black sites, black prison sites, places like Guantanamo Bay. Where we know that they were using, quote, enhanced interrogation techniques, things like that.
The other two cults that were pretty heavily involved with the CIA, I don't know if they came up other than Manson, was the Heaven's Gate cult and Jones, Reverend Jones in Guyana.
And they didn't bring a whole lot of that up. Not yet. Now, granted, they did to an extent with modern means, because they get into, like we've talked about, how they know, you think it's nanotech, folks. They don't need nanotech. You don't need to breathe anything in to be controlled. They can push the masses and push you and certain personality types with mere dialogue online. And they get into that, and they get into the fact of, is that where MKUltra has basically gone now, to the point of algorithm, you know, as we talked about with our good old friend, Robert Duncan, all the time, the idea of algorithm and what pushes the conversation. I mean, even Hosni Mubarak, we quote it all the time. Like, that was a Facebook group, man. That was a Facebook group that took down a dictator.
Yeah. And then you had under Obama the Brain Initiative, and the Nudge Squad, that their job was strictly to get online and try to nudge people to believe a certain way. I mean, that wasn't hidden, you know, that was, you know, in the public square.
Well, and, you know, at the same time, the Smith-Mundt Act was stricken down. Then they tried putting government watchdogs inside of newsrooms to assure the fact that, quote, approved messages were going out, all kinds of things. So, yeah, like, we know that we control dialogue. We know that these things happen. Let's get into MK Naomi here in just a second. We're going to hear about MK Naomi, which includes, like, the Edgewood experiments. The Edgewood experiments were basically what the movie Jacob's Ladder was based on, where they were trying to use LSD in a gaseous form to be able to basically swath over a group of people to either make them docile or to be able to once again possibly change their minds all at the same time, things like that. So let's hear a little bit about MK Naomi and Operation Paperclip and the experiments and how these things are related to MK Ultra.
Naomi, in your research, and if you could please press the button.
My understanding of MK Naomi is that it was a joint project between the military and the CIA. And there's a big difference because the MK Ultra project was aimed at seizing control of the minds of individuals. The Army was interested in something different, which was trying to use biological agents in warfare against entire populations. So MK Naomi is the place where these two goals overlapped.
And that was the 1953 Frank Olson death. Was that in a way tied to that from some chatter that we had seen?
Exactly what the motivation was behind the decision about Frank Olson, if there was such a decision, is unknown.
My next question is also for you, sir. Operation Paperclip brought over 1,600 German scientists into the United States government after World War II, including individuals who had conducted human experimentation in concentration camps. The CIA and military were aware of their backgrounds and recruited them anyways. In your research, did you find direct documentation between Paperclip scientists and the development of MKUltra's experimental protocols, specifically the use of mescaline, hypnosis, and sensory deprivation, which were techniques also documented at Dachau?
Absolutely. Kurt Blome, who was the chief of biological weapons development for the Nazi government, came to work for the CIA. So did Walter Schreiber, who was the Surgeon General of the Nazi Army. I can just tell a brief story.
Just a few off the hit list.
Well, and so did Strugfeld, who was actually their aerospace expert, who had done a lot of altitude experimentations on non-willing participants to see how far you could go up in an aircraft before you blow up. And he wound up being the father of American aerospace medicine, and actually had a library named after him here in San Antonio on base. It's only been about 5 or 6 years ago that they changed the name after it came to light publicly that he was an Operation Paperclip inductee.
Yeah. Yeah, exactly. And we had numerous programs that leaned on that stuff, that brought those scientists over, that utilized those scientists. And once again, here's the thing. We shot monkeys into space. We did all kinds of wild shit, man. All kinds of stuff for God and country and to beat the Ruskies at it. All right. Yeah. As soon as we heard beep, beep, beep from Sputnik, game was on. Things were different. And no doubt we did some horrifying things. We sent dogs up there that didn't make it back. We sent people to launch pads that just burned up on them. All kinds of stuff. But when you are talking recruiting the people from Dachau, now, like, these weren't like Wunderweppen guys that were like, hey, you know, yeah, we're working on like Andy Gravitic technologies, or, you know, we're working on Foo Fighters. No, no, no. These were the engineers of death. We knew exactly what they were. We knew exactly what they did and what they were doing. That's why we went over there and shut them down and went after it, you know. So the CIA at the time, not the CIA, it would have been the OSS at the time. OSS knew exactly what those guys were up to. They knew exactly what they were doing. They'd seen the papers. They'd seen the work. And they brought them directly over to continue that line of work. And that is nefarious. Like, that's different than, hey, we're going to create a rocket and go to space or go to the moon and things like that. That is 180 degrees different, man.
Yeah. And it wasn't just the Germans. The Japanese had a couple of labs that were doing a lot of that same experiment too. And you don't hear much about that. And I don't know if any of their scientists were brought over or not. That's been kind of whitewashed through the years.
Interesting. So, Interesting, because they, I think if anything, they would have probably maybe had a step or two engineering wise electronically.
Yeah.
On some stuff. You know, but it's fascinating when you think about those things, when you think about the programs that they allowed to continue to exist and that they just continued and relabeled right over here, you know. And once again, these programs, as we've come to find out over the years, included even kids, man. It wasn't just prisoners. There were, and I guess some of those prisoners were kids. There were juvenile halls involved. There were boys' youth camps involved, all kinds of stuff. That all of these things happened. And
the hepatitis B vaccine that we have currently was actually the initial experimentation on that was done at a special needs school for children. I mean, yeah. That vaccine was tested on kids unwillingly.
Yeah. So. Yeah. And you know, when you start getting into things, the next clip I'm going to play is from Mr. O'Neill. And he gets into Sub-Project 43. And that is specifically in regards to Jack Ruby, Colonel West, or West, like we were talking about, and JFK. And they talked earlier about the death in New York of the famed colonel who supposedly jumped out of a window, was really more pushed out of a window. And how all of these things are connected.
Sidney Gottlieb, who ran MK Ultra program for the CIA, hired West as a contractor to conduct research for Subproject 43, combining hypnotism, drugs, and sensory deprivation to create disassociative states, in which, to quote Mr. Kinzer in his book Poisoner in Chief, the human mind could be pulled away from its moorings. Following the assassination of President John F. Kennedy, West psychiatrically examined Jack Ruby, then in prison for murdering the president accused of the assassination, Lee Harvey Oswald, the assassin accused of murdering President Kennedy, Lee Harvey Oswald. A report emerged from West's examination said that Ruby had suffered an acute psychotic break. Can you explain why Dr. West in particular was chosen to conduct an examination of Jack Ruby alone in his jail cell with no other psychologist present?
Be happy to. West inserted himself into the case when Ruby was the day of the shooting, the day after the shooting, West approached the judge in the preliminary hearings and asked to be assigned to the case. He was refused by the judge. After Ruby was convicted at his first trial, an associate of West, Dr. Hubert Winston Smith, who was a psychiatrist and an attorney, took over Ruby's defense for his appeal. And he had already discussed appointing Ruby to the case, or excuse me, West to the case. And as you said, West examined Ruby alone at the jail cell and emerged to announce that in the preceding 48 hours, he had had an acute psychotic break from which he would never recover. He had been declared competent to stand trial in the first time by a panel of, I think, 8 psychiatrists. This psychotic break lasted until his death in 1967. 2 months after West examined him, Ruby testified for the first time and only time to the Warren Commission. And it was the first time he ever publicly was supposed to say what his reasons were for shooting Oswald. The testimony had to be halted because he was babbling incoherently. And as Arlen Specter, who was a counsel to the commission, wrote in his memoirs, he pulled him aside and said that they were cutting off the arms and legs of children in Albuquerque and El Paso. And he said he was making no sense whatsoever.
Yeah. Yeah. And that's what happened to Jack Ruby when he was supposed to testify before the Warren Commission regarding why he shot JFK.
Oswald.
Or Oswald, yes.
Yeah.
Yes,
yeah.
Oswald. He didn't shoot JFK, folks. I don't even think he shot JFK.
And Oswald probably didn't either.
He didn't even have an umbrella that day, nothing. But he was definitely part of all that. And that's just it. You know, these tendrils go far and wide. And when you look at, once again, the methodology of how do we break the brain so that we can rebuild it, that is a dangerous precipice that goes. And, you know, later on, they get into patriotism and the guises through which these things are done, you know. But even then, it's one of those that is an extreme mentality to think that even subjecting hundreds of people to this is worth the greater cause.
Well, and that's what we're still looking at today. Is MK Ultra didn't end. The research into it ended, you know, and the they hid it a little better. They changed the monikers. But I mean, Havana syndrome and the effects that it's had on the public population, other than just the diplomats that have been affected by it, are at least initially were all a continuing part of the research. Now, I don't know how much of it is still experimentation now. I mean, they figured out what works. I mean, it's been working for some time. So, you know, initially that's why, you know, we were all looking for implants and looking for microchips, and we found some in some people. But even the early MK Ultra researchers, had said that, that everything that they did with STIMO receivers and implants now could be done with broadcasting. So, I mean, no need to have to actually physically assault someone in order to put them under some form of control.
Well, and that's just it. And that's what we've said over and over is, and that's what they say in this, is that there is no longer the need for a chemical in the water. There is no longer a need for any kind of physical presence on somebody to make this happen. And when you start getting into those methodologies, when you start looking at those things, when you start considering the fact that, yes, these were once again programs that were looked at, highly researched, at the time, more money than NASA was being poured into this, man. More money than the space race. And when you think about that, when you stop and think about that, how fast did we get to the moon within a decade, you know, of the charge happening? We were there. So,
see, and that's why I think, I mean, a lot of the population still kind of see, you know, these are conspiracy theories at least. But at worst, it's happening to somebody else, and it's not something I've got to worry about because I'm just a regular citizen going about my day, and it's not going to happen to me. If you're watching TV, if you're on a computer, or you're carrying a cell phone,
it's happening to you.
It's happening to you.
And that's just it. At one point, you needed to be within a radius of a water supply. That's what they get into, is that now the technology and the algorithms are so nefarious that, and I mean, I've covered it before in the UFO UAP community. One of the articles that caused all of this declassification noise to begin with was one, Black Budgets, Black Money, Black Budgets and UFOs, you know, by Leslie Keene, and Ralph Blumenthal in the New York Times. There was a secondary article about a year and a half, 2 years later, a few years later, I guess just a couple years ago, actually, because that was like 2017 almost. And this article was talking about how the alphabet agencies no longer employ PSYOP officers like they used to when it comes to the world of UFO and UAP. They tap the community.
Yeah.
Zero need to employ a PSYOP officer to come up with some crazy cover story when we're sitting there coming up with them and sharing them on social media.
Yeah, and you know? Press actually, it works in conjunction with the CIA spreading their propaganda as well. Because I don't know if you remember when Havana syndrome first broke. You know, after I got talked to on a couple of radio shows, including yours, then immediately Psychology Today had an article out saying this was all mass hysteria. Then they had other experts popping out that were unknown, you know, saying it was permethrin, from trying to spray the, a chemical that we've been using for 100 years now. All of a sudden it's making people hear voices.
Yeah.
You know, and so, I mean, that's kind of the scary thing, is that everybody kind of needs to get a handle on this, or and at least believe it, because it's going to take all of us to kind of fight it.
That's just it. That's just it. And I think if anything, this is the beginnings of that. We eventually got to a point that we had a David Grush up there talking about UFOs and black budgets and money being hidden, to the point that the last hearing that happened, one of the last hearings that happened, Doctor, we had active duty members of the Navy talking about encounters that they had aboard ship. Active duty, that is huge. That's huge. The fact that active duty members of the Navy were on a UFO whistleblowing panel talking about their experiences, that's massive.
Well, and I think you're going to see that a lot of what we talk about with targeting and the technology that causes targeting is going to end up overlapping with some of the UFO stuff, because I'm still convinced that, you know, even Dr. Stephen Greer says that while he does obviously believe in extraterrestrial life, that most of the craft and stuff that you see are actually human made, you know, and I'm kind of wondering if a lot of what people are reporting as abductions are actually just another sub project of MK Ultra and part of the targeting phenomenon.
Well, and, you know, there has been talk of my labs and things like that for years, you know, programs that are used to abduct people and fake abductions, things like that. So
if I was going to experiment on some people that and it required me abducting them, I sure would want them to think that it was an alien doing it instead of my agency.
Sure. Sure. You know? And that is a viable reality in many ways. Even whenever you talk to the point of being able to mechanize other thought forms, and that's what they get into in this also, is the fact that, you know, that not only were they able to break people's thoughts, but they were able to implant other thought forms in somebody's head. They were able to make somebody think something else. And here's a little bit about the technology and its success.
For coming today to testify about MK Ultra, Dr. Genexi, you said you worked for the NIH. Is that correct?
Oh, I'm sorry. That is the wrong clip here. Let me see if I can find this. This was it 57? I guess it was 57. Here we go.
Continue. I don't know. I can't imagine that it didn't, though, because the technology that they worked to establish over 20, 25 years and spent more money on than any operation the CIA had ever conducted was successful. I imagine it's being used. I have no evidence of it being used, so it's a complete assumption.
I would just add that one of the letters to which Mr. O'Neill referred contains a quote from Mr. Gottlieb saying that these experiments were necessary, quote, in these times. I think it's important to put yourself back in that mindset where the United States felt that it was under such overwhelming threat that the loss of a few lives or a few hundred lives was a small price to pay. Commitment to a great cause is one of the most fundamental justifications for committing immoral acts. And patriotism is among the most noble of causes. It can be twisted, and it can be used as an excuse to carry out research under the guise that this is simply research we're doing to protect ourselves against others. And I think that is a mindset that may still be active in some parts of our government.
The greater good.
Yeah. Yeah. And that's just it. You know, when you get it, and that's the whole box that was taken from Tulsi Gabbard's office recently, that's We were told after the church committee hearings, once again, that these things would be defunded, that we would not be experimenting en masse on the public like that anymore, that these things couldn't happen, waving fingers, this and that, unless it's a matter of national security.
And it's always a matter of national security. And they're not lying in one aspect.
Yep.
I mean, they kind of have defunded it directly from the government because it's private contractors that are handling most of this technology now. Yeah. I mean, I've talked to you about one company that I actually was reached out to from, and they made it clear to me. They said, yeah, we can watch it from miles away from space. You know, we can, you know, read the label on your jacket from miles away in space. We can make you go to the bathroom. We can give you severe headaches, or we can vaporize you altogether. So, and that particular company leases their technology to the CIA and the NSA.
So, yeah, precisely. And when you start, and that's just it, you know, no different than I've said whenever we discuss remote viewing, no different than I've said whenever we discuss any of these things, they go into compartmentalization like that. No, we don't. We don't spend money researching remote viewing anymore. We don't use remote viewers. We use human gathered intelligence. Human is what we use. Now, whether or not their contractors who help provide human are using remote viewing or not is a different story.
Yeah.
Much like changing UFO to UAP. Cool that it got science involved, but it was real sneaky and they didn't really let us know until we found out that they started Arrow. So there was a while there that they got away with not being able to fill out FOIA requests or not having to, because they were looking for UFOs. That's not what this was whatsoever.
And instead of Havana syndrome, it's now anomalous health incidents, AHIs.
Yeah. That's just it. That's just it, you know. And when you start looking at all these things, when you start looking at, once again, the nefarious history of this stuff, man, because and I am a believer. I am not a fear monger. I've been accused of that when we've talked. Somebody mentioning like, oh, you know, you're fear mongering this and that. Nobody's fear mongering. We are stating fact. And we are stating well-versed fact about what this topic is and about what it is and how it comes to be. And the issue that it comes down to is, yes, there are tons of conspiracy theories out there. There are tons of things out there that maybe our government was a part of, things like that. This is one that we can prove, hands down, absolutely, all day long, our government did this. They did it and they kept doing it and they did it for almost 20 years and are likely to have continued doing it under other means. Once again, 149 sub-programs. That's just what we know about from unredacted documents. The rest of it's all redacted. We have no idea. We don't know what these things are. We don't know
how
far.
And when they're successful, they don't end.
Yeah.
They get
shuffled off once again to subcontractors and users thereof so that they can be used in ways that are extrajudicial is the only way to put it. Ways that where they can be used sans government oversight, sans oversight committee, things like that. And that's what we're finding out about UFO UAP. That's what we're finding out about all kinds of things. And much like the hearings with that, once again, I think this is an onboarding conversation. And there has to be a few of them, man. Because you and I get into things sometimes. We get into some thick stuff, you know, that the average listener would just be like, what? Because we're jumping into it from the point of view of people who have been researching it and who are involved in the communities and who people come to for answers sometimes, you know.
Well, whereas, I've been at it for long enough that at least with the, you know, the electronic technologies that we've talked about, you know, 20 years ago when, you know, when I first got into this, I mean, just talking about it, you know, even talking about it, you know, scientifically, you were still basically labeled, you know, as crazy, you know, and now we're, to a point where, you know, when I have go on shows like yours or other shows, I mean, people reach out and I mean, just about everybody knows somebody or has a family member that's been affected now. I mean, and that's why I actually wrote in my book 10, 15 years ago that some of these terms were going to be household terms eventually. And they have become that.
No. And that's just it. That's just it. And, you know, there's probably a good 30, 40 minutes of this that we didn't get a chance to cover tonight. The them talking about Luna asked about USAID and CIA and connections to Operation Mockingbird. And once again, that was the idea of using Red Cross news and things like that to help disseminate information and help disseminate things behind lines while they were doing humanitarian aid to help convince people and populations over to the democratic cause and over to the cause of whatever CIA band was helping infiltrate. Or, you know, same thing with dropping pamphlets in Cuba, that kind of stuff. And all these things were hugely part of MKUltra. So when you consider, once again, the tendrils with which it was attached, man, the Edgewood experiments, where they were working on weaponization of these hallucinogens to be able to use against not only soldiers in the field, but populace possibly. It's wild. Well,
every single person in modern society just about uses Facebook, you know, and you know, while we're talking about using other organizations that are CIA funded, NQTEL is the money that actually started Facebook. You know, so Facebook, you know, was kind of from the get-go was an intelligence gathering. I mean, you don't have to do much intrusion when somebody's putting, you know, everything, you know, on there for them. So, you know, a Human Ecology Fund was one of the big ones, you know, back during the early MKUltra days that, I mean, they do come at you guised as humanitarian organizations sometimes.
Absolutely. And I remember the stories of, you know, Amnesty International being a front, like all kinds of things like that, you know. Even, you know, some of the humanitarian aid that went overseas for ministry, stuff like that was specifically, and that's where Jim Jones, that kind of stuff got tied in. And I'm going to go out with one more clip here, and this was toward the end of things, where they talk about mass conversions and Mockingbird and things like that. This is a couple minutes, but let's check out this one last clip here.
I think that had something to do with the France incident that you were talking about earlier. Again, today, it's all speculation, but back then, they were trying to use psychological means to see what you could, how you could influence people's thoughts. And Mockingbird played into that, which, if people don't know, that was where they had CIA assets or co-opted people in the media who would write basically propaganda and try to control the thoughts and beliefs of the population to what the CIA needed. And is it still going on today? I would be surprised if it wasn't.
Sure. I think we saw it even during COVID with all of the NIH funding that went to COVID and the Wuhan lab and then everything that came out of that, trying to make people believe in something that wasn't there. Dr. Kinzer, do you have anything on this?
I would say only that in the modern age, maybe radio waves and drugs are not necessary to control people's minds. We have such a great advertising, propaganda, press, social media collaboration, that certain opinions are marginalized and real debate is frustrated because people are not given access to full amounts of information. So that's a way of controlling the minds of populations. It doesn't even require sophisticated electronic or psychopharmacological means.
Anything else you'd like to add for our next?
Exactly.
There you go.
And you know, like we say all the time, these things go a whole lot deeper. There is a surface part to it. There is much like any illness, there is a symptomology out there, you know, and these things are still being utilized. These concepts are still being used. The playbook, the dirty playbook, that exists by the CIA. I have a copy of it. I used to keep it right here. But yeah, just the CIA Book of Dirty Tricks is what it's called.
Well, and that's why in like, you know, my books, I've always, and in my interviews, I've always made the comment, a lot of victims and people that are involved in this are always like, well, we need techniques of blocking and techniques to fight it. And, you know, the ultimate solution is going to be political. So, and that's kind of the direction I always go. The technology's not going to go away. They haven't spent billions of dollars on control technologies to control mass populations and individuals in order just to say, well, you know, it works. We're going to stop using it now. I mean, the best we can hope for is to get people in that have the morality and the ethical background to actually enforce correct oversight on the agencies that have it, in which is even going to be more difficult now that it's being farmed out to contractors and privately owned companies. But I mean, that's the direction it's going to have to go. No individual is ever going to have the billions of dollars to have the technology to be able to block it. As a matter of fact, most of what we talk about with targeting, I'm not even so sure the government can block it.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, and once again, though, if you are tilling the ground, if you are making your mind a fertile playground for this technology to begin with, it doesn't take much. It doesn't take a lot, you know? It doesn't take a lot to join into a conspiratorial mindset. It doesn't take a lot to become a victim mentality in that kind of way when things are happening to you, doctor. And when, especially when you believe things may be happening to you in a different way, than typical. So yeah, it's hard. And I know it's hard for you. Both of us work for the fact of what can we do for everybody. But at the same time, like I've been saying, like we say all the time on the show, it will be a legal means, the same way that hopefully we will get an Oliver North of UFO, UAP black money that'll be standing up eventually and going, yeah, I helped write the checks. I helped dispense the money. This is where it went. You know,
an interesting thing that I came across today, just real quickly. The UFO thing. I'm not obviously a big player in that. I mean, I really don't know what I think on that. But Phil McGraw has got a series on Facebook now where he's kind of addressing the UAE phenomenon and seems to be kind of a believer. You know, which kind of shocked me because at least for the technologies that we talk about that are, you know, a continuation of MK Ultra, he's absolutely annihilated targeted individuals on his show.
Yeah.
You know, but I saw him coming out with a 3-part series on Facebook talking and trying to explain the UFO phenomenon as a believer. And I actually left a comment on one of his. I said, man, it's about time you've got a clue, man. I'm proud of you.
And that's the thing. And I don't fault anybody. My dad is, I love you, Dad. He just got out of the hospital. If you're listening, which I doubt, much like my weird old music, my dad doesn't listen to too many of the shows because it's just a little too out there for him. As Art Bell was for a lot of people of his age and ilk, you know, So for him, things like UFOs and little green men are a non-starter of a conversation, John.
Yeah.
They're things like targeted individuals and MK Ultra are a non-starter of a conversation. We dealt with that. It's over. Didn't we give somebody some money or something?
Yeah.
You know? Well, that's where they're at with it.
Well, Dr. Phil's recent Facebook post, he said, the government is lying to us. And, you know, and I'm like, you think, you know,
and that's just it, you know, is the fact of, and you can feel free to look this up, folks. I've said it on the show numerous times and said it on numerous shows recently. You feel free to Google when the CIA has told the truth the first time. When asked about any black budget project, it has never happened. Second or third time they're questioned about it, maybe they'll pry something loose and let you know. But anytime they've been asked the first time, it is always deny, deny, deny. There is nothing. There's nothing. There's nothing. The fact that more documents that were found have been taken in the name of national security should tell us alone what this is knocking on the door of, you know, and that there is other stuff there that obviously, names aside, they want to hide of some kind of culpability, you know? I think the things with the UFO stuff is very much a controlled trickle. It is basically a conglomerating of data that has already been out there in the communities, but it's a conglomeration of data somewhere that the average person can find it and look at it now and at least go, well, dang, I guess our government did spend billions of dollars looking into this for decades and decades and decades. Holy cow. Maybe there's something to it. And now it's a conversation. 'Cause that's the only way we get there, man. That's the only way we get there. We have to let people, like, if you think that's a conversation, wait till you hear the mind-numbing conversation about mind control and the nefarious things that we actually did that you think are conspiracy theory that are a horrifying fact, you know?
Well, and hopefully this hearing will set the stage for more to come.
Yes.
I guess if Representative Luna, you know, can actually, you know, keep it going, because I imagine she's going to have some backlash for this. So,
well, and you know, once again, I think that with diagnoses and medical diagnoses out there now for Havana syndrome and for those kind of things, especially in the military medical books. That kind of stuff. That is a different conversation, you know. I think that they are doing a good job with this panel to disclose government secrets. I think they are doing a fantastic job tackling things one issue at a time and showing the fact that it's a legal solution. It's a legal solution that takes these things. We'll be having that conversation all of next week with Stephen Bassett and Paradigm Research Institute, who's been working on the front end of disclosure in Washington for better than the last decade, you know? So, these are huge conversations. They're ground shaking conversations. So I want to thank you as always for coming on, helping crack open this hard, hard topic. 'Cause it's a thick one, man. And it's one that is deep rooted in a lot of things.
Always a pleasure to have on. I mean, you've been a big advocate for this topic, and when a lot of other people wouldn't touch it. So I'll give you kudos for that.
Thank you. Always. Well, before we let you go, let everybody know where they can go to find your books, where they can go to find Guinea Pigs, Technologies and Control, and A New Breed, Satellite Weapons in America.
Facebook. Yeah. Guinea Pigs, Technology of Control, Facebook page, Barnes and Nobles, Amazon, you know, be trying to get a second book out too, but I'm also starting a new medical practice. So I've been kind of busy with that. So
good. Well, Awesome. Doctor, thank you so much, as always, for your time. Hold the line real quick while we close things out with the audience. While you are online, everybody, getting your copy of Guinea Pigs, Technologies of Control, make sure to stop on by Curious Realm. CuriousRealm.com/videos is where you can find that declassified government panels playlist. That is also where you can find our store full of all of the videos, music, books, everything by our guests. Thank you so much, as always, everybody, for your time tonight, for your open hearts, your open minds. That is what makes the conversation. And without the conversation, humanity does not march forward. So remember, take care of yourselves, take care of each other, and stay curious. We'll talk to you soon. Bye-bye.
Thank you for tuning into this episode of The Curious Realm. Stay tuned for more guests, forbidden topics, and hidden truths. Follow us on social media by searching Curious Realm. To download the official Curious Realm app and view the Knowledge Vault, or become a sponsor of Curious Realm, visit our website at CuriousRealm.com. Curious Realm is available on your favorite podcast and video services, CuriousRealm.com, as well as KGRA Radio, APR TV, and the official Curious Realm app for Roku devices. Curious Realm is a proud member of the Ground Zero Media family of podcasts. For more shows and members-only content, visit groundzeroplus.com today. Thanks for listening. Stay curious, and remember, the other side is always watching.